hello everyone, and welcome to Between the Sheets, episode number 11 now, Bix? Are we 11?
Yes.
Yeah, I sounded like Ron Burgundy for a second reading the teleprompter. San Diego?
Hello. Ron Burgundy?
Yeah, we are number 11 weeks strong, so hey, we made it this long. And of course, I'm here tonight with my co-host, David Pix's Fan Pix. How's it going?
I don't know, not great. My microphone broke.
Well, at least we can hear you, and that's all that matters. You know, God, I've spoke to people on regular telephone, and, you know, we did the MSG reaction show last night on Place to Be Nation, and Dylan was sounding like he was underwater, which he lives in Charleston, South Carolina, and he basically is underwater, sadly. But, anyway.
Also, what was it? What was the name of the animal that was chirping outside Bariqua's house when you did the cologne show?
Oh, I can't remember. I had to look at the thread on PWO.
Oh, I know what it's called. Not Chimera. Why am I forgetting this all of a sudden?
It gave a great local character to the podcast, I thought.
Yes.
Well, you know, that one time we did the show with Dylan where he was outside and had the sounded like Augusta National. You know, we're at the Masters with the birds chirping. I thought that was great. So, but
we have a guest.
Enough about that. Let's talk about our guest. We have a longtime newsletter subscriber and a guy who hits all the major events, procures some footage for us to watch on sometimes, and that's Michael Rogaleski. Mike, what's going on?
Hey, what's going on, guys? Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Great to have you on the show. And tonight we have a loaded show because we are talking about September 29th through October the 5th, 1996, our first foray into a pivotal year in pro wrestling. And we're right now in the early stages of WCW's domination. But we'll end with them and we'll start with the World Wrestling Federation, which we ended with World Wrestling Federation on our last show. And there's a lot going on in this promotion right now because they're in complete free fall.
Well, there's a lot going on everywhere, though. This might be the most loaded week we've done so far.
There's so much going on. But this promotion, my God. And we lead off with some dire straits from them in New York City, which is pretty interesting since they had the MSG show last night on the network, because on September 29th, they drew one of the lowest paid attendances ever at Madison Square Garden, 40 years plus that they run there, with 67.47 paid. I mean, that's, because you look at the glory days, and they were doing 20,000 strong plus, and now they're down to 67.47. So that's a big problem.
I have a question. So the lowest crowd in 40 years thing, I would guess that, so if we're going back to 56, so wait, that means that they actually outdrew, that McMahon actually outdrew, McMahon Sr. actually outdrew that when they had no TV.
Yeah. And
because 40 years would be pre-Vince McMahon Sr.
Exactly. And it's funny you mention that because they didn't have TV in New York at this time. One of the big issues for WWF in New York, in the NYC metro area, is they had no syndicated television air. They only have Monday Night Raw, which is the first time they didn't have TV in the market since 1968. So there was no localized interviews for the market, which, you know, WWF was known for all their localized interviews over the years. And there's plenty of them on YouTube. You can go check them out. Now, they did have 30-second ads that aired during Raw, but they only promoted the main events of the show. And this all stemmed from the decision by the promotion earlier in the year to no longer pay the stations to air their television shows. So they lost television in over 50% of the country because of that. That's tough.
You know, I'm sorry to cut you off. What's interesting is that they had, in January and May, that those two garden shows were two of like the, well, the May was the first sellout in years and years. And then January was like a really, really huge house for Sean. I think it was like Sean's first match back after the concussion deal. So it looked like business was on this huge upswing. And then all of a sudden they go from having the first sellout in years to the lowest in as far as back as anyone can remember.
Well, May was curtain call.
Yeah.
And the August show though, they did 11,000 there with Sean against Goldust in the main event. So they were still doing, I mean, double what they almost did here in the month before.
But the really big one, I think, was Shawn and Diesel against Bret and Undertaker, right?
Yeah, Yeah, that was February, Mania?
Yeah, I mean, they had, that's right, because that was March. That was like the 2 weeks before Mania. They had three in a row that were really huge. They had the curtain call was the sellout. The March show was the one Bix just mentioned was a huge house. I don't know if it was – was that a sellout, Bix?
I'm not sure if it was a sellout. I just remember it doing they incredibly set a record. Well. It might have been the gate record or something.
Yeah, they set a gate record for consecutive shows, like three in a row or something like that.
Yeah, the January one was like a Shawn versus Hunter match, with Shawn's first match back like when he returned at the Rumble the week before. And those were like, yeah, those were three huge houses in a row.
Yeah, and that weekend they also ran Detroit and Pittsburgh, and Detroit and Pittsburgh drew more pay fans, although not by much, over New York City, which was unheard of. And wow. It appears that WF is trying to get back on syndication on WBIS New York, but WCW is expected to get an 11 a.m. Saturday morning slot on that station shortly. Now, here's something to pay attention to for the future. The idea of doing a late Saturday Night Live television show from New York with a more hardcore theme is back on the table. Details aren't available as nothing has been finalized as to whether they can get the show on cable, do the show weekly, or as a monthly special, or even go back to the original idea of doing it as a PPV event. And, of course, that would become Shotgun Saturday Night. But real quick, before we talk about the show, Bix, I mean, you're a New York guy.
So is Mike.
So is Mike. That's the home market. And they have no television locally in their home market. That's insane.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this on a few shows because I think it kept creeping up on the 95 shows that, you know, first there was the whole thing with the baseball preemptions on Fox 5 here in New York, which had been their home station going back to, I think, 87.
Yeah.
And then, you know, eventually they just gave up. And also they took Superstars out of syndication. I want to say that would have been the beginning of the season, right? So
yeah,
right around this week, actually, right? When was the last Superstars?
The last Superstars, I think, was like the second week of September.
So it was a couple weeks before this, and then they moved it to USA.
Yeah.
So the only syndicated show left at this point was, the Wrestling Challenge had been renamed simply WWF Challenge and was a recap show. So that was all that was left. And so now they're thinking about re-entering syndication. For those in New York who don't recognize WBIS, that's LNY now, right? Mike?
I think so. Yeah, that sounds right.
Right, because that was where they did end up launching Shotgun Saturday Night a few months later. And yeah, it was such a weird time. And Mike Michael, go along with me on that. Superstars just started to just not air anymore in New York. I mean, God, I mean, it was always at different times each week with the baseball and everything. But I want to say that in, like, 96, I don't remember seeing the show more than half a dozen times.
Yeah, I remember, like, the really – for us in New York, it was really annoying that summer in particular, 96, because the show would, like – it used to air at noon, and then the baseball would preempt it to, like, 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But the baseball would always run long, and they would always just join Superstars in Progress. So some weeks we were only getting, like, the last 15 minutes or the last half hour, and, like, you'd have to watch Action Zone the next day to see what – you know, they'd show most of it the next day on Action Zone usually. But in clip form. So I remember, it was real annoying. And then and the thing too is, just by missing the first 15 minutes of the show, if we only missed that, you already missed out on the Doc Hendricks Slam Jam countdown for the next Garden show, which is probably the most important thing they were paying for that time to have.
And we didn't get the finale that the first 10 years show that they did.
That's right. Yeah, we didn't get that either. They did a similar one on the last episode of Action Zone. They basically did the same thing though, didn't they?
It was either Action Zone or no, it would have been Action Zone, I guess.
I think they showed most of it.
I don't think they showed that. I think they did. I think they did that thing with Howard Finkel narrating that video that was set to the knockoff of Miserloo.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Where he's just going into different wrestlers' names that they're just kind of randomly connected. So it was like Typhoon, Monsoon, that whole thing.
Oh, God, I remember that.
Yeah.
That was just a weird time in WWE television.
Oh, and the Smoky Mountain knockoff theme song for Superstars.
Right. Yeah. And we had Superstars here. It was out of Macon. And it aired all the way to the end. And I think it aired on like 12 o'clock on Saturday or something like that in the afternoon.
And did you get the recap version of Challenge at all?
No, not by then. It had been gone from Atlanta syndication. But I just remember that, you know, we'll go over some of these names. Oh, I might as well go over now. This is the type of names that you saw on WWF television in 1996, because this is the Madison Square Garden card. Mm-hmm. And this is why you'll see why the show did so bad. We had Salvatore Sincere going over Bob Holly. We have Justin Hawk Bradshaw going over Alex Porto. We have Jake the Snake Roberts over T.L. Hopper.
Oh, man.
The great Tony Anthony. We have Barry Windham, who's a stalker, I think, at this time, going over the Goon.
Okay, I want to interrupt for a second, though, because if you notice, the first four matches on the card are all your bring-in veteran indie guys to be glorified jobbers guys. It's all those guys they brought in at that same time.
And the Goon is Wild Bill Irwin.
Right.
All right, then we have your tag titles.
Wait,
and
why is the Goon the one guy that we're... Well, I guess because the one guy that you're naming here... I mean, Alex Porto got to keep his name, but for those who, for some reason, might not remember, of course, T.L. Hopper is our beloved Dirty White Boy, Tony
Anthony. That's what I said. Yeah, I said it's Tony
I didn't hear you say... Oh, okay. Yeah. I feel like an idiot because I feel like I keep doing this every show now. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, and then we had Elimination Match for Tag Titles, Owen and Davey going over the Goblins, Smoking Guns, and the Grimm Twins, who, of course, were the Bruise Brothers, Ron and Don Harris. Then we have Vader going over Psycho Sid in a Lumberjack match after Steve Austin hit the stunner on Sid. Then we have Triple H going over Freddie Joe Floyd, the legendary Tracy Smothers.
You know, this might actually be the show, because I think this is the only Garden show Smothers worked, right?
I think so.
Okay. He stayed at our friend Brian Last house for the show.
He wasn't in that Survivor Series match, the pre-show match?
It might have been Survivor Series.
Okay, yeah. One or two. It wasn't more than two.
But yes, that sounded like an adventure, though.
Yeah.
I'm talking to Brian.
I'm sure it was, knowing Brian and Tracy together. And then we had Steve Austin and Savio Vega, which they were feuding forever.
Yeah.
It's awesome going over. Then we have Mark Merrow defending his Intercontinental title, going over Farouk by DQ, which was supposed to be Farouk versus Yokozuna, but Yoko was having his health problems. And then we had the main event, Shawn and Undertaker going over Mankind and Goldust in a 30-minute match. And Michaels used super kick on Goldust after kissing him. Brian Pillman made his Madison Square Garden debut on this show in a segment with Sonny, which ended up being with the Smoking Guns involved and blah, 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 blah. But you see, I mean, look at the talent on the show. You got all these guys that were working, you know, Smoky Mountain Wrestling or working other places, you know, under these stupid-ass gimmicks. This is also around the time period as well, wasn't it, where Steve Armstrong was Lance Cassidy?
No, that was 92.
92. God, why am I thinking? 92. Man. I don't know how I got that confused. But anyway, Al Snow had been there as Leaf Cassidy, you know, a little bit before this. I mean, it was just like one of those insulting deals where you get these guys that you know, and they're in these horrible gimmicks, and it's just too hokey. And you got WCW, you know, changing the game, you know, with NWO getting hot. And WWE just, it seemed like a promotion that was just past this time period, Mike. I mean, they needed an answer and fast.
Yeah, and you think of just everything from that time. Look at the house show lineup. Think of Raw at that time. They would do 4 weeks at a time. By the time they got to the third or fourth week, you were watching it, and you were just like, this stuff, this seems so old and dated with all these gimmicks. Even their production was like, WWF was known for its production at the time. But, I mean, for years they were. And then you compare it to turning, you flip to Nitro, and you see that this the world of difference. And Nitro was blowing them away in production for the first time, like, ever. One thing I wanted to throw in about the attendance was I don't know if it was on. I know Vince did an interview that week. He either did it on AOL or on Czech Kopic's. I feel like it might have been a Czech Kopic show, and someone called in and asked him about the attendance. Like, what did you think about, you know, the Garden show this week doing one of the lowest crowds and you know, as long as anyone can remember? And his response was, people knew Survivor Series was going to be the next show at the Garden, so they waited for the next show. I definitely remember reading that. I don't remember if it was on Czech Kopic or because he used to be on Czech Kopic every now and then, so it was either on that or on one of his AOL chats. And I was like, that's probably the worst excuse I've ever heard.
You know, I went to the Nassau show like about it was just about exactly a month before this, and I'm looking at it now. at least in total attendance, did slightly barely more than the Garden show. And I'm not sure what that says about it either. And I'm looking at...
Was that that tag team show? It was all tag matches?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what the official subtitle was, but it was the all tag...
And it's the one where Jim Neidhart comes back as like,
Sid's
without
mystery
the mask.
Partner.
Yeah, Sid's mystery partner, Jim Neidhart.
Yeah, and I won, wow. It was cool, because I won free tickets to the show on the very first episode of Get in the Ring on WGGB 1240 AM.
Who was that? Was that Rich Mancuso?
Sir Adam and the Phantom.
Oh, okay.
Anyway.
Oh, my goodness.
So listen to this lineup. So 6,823 people at Nassau. The Bushwhackers defeated Justin Hawk Bradshaw and Uncle Zebekiah. The Grimm Twins defeated Marty Jannetty and Leif Cassidy.
There we go.
Who were replacing the Body Donnas because of Candido's neck injury. Mark Merrow and Savio Vega defeated Steve Austin and Hunter Hearst Helmsley.
What a team.
Goldust and Mankind defeated Jake the Stink Roberts and The Undertaker. The Godwins defeated Smoking Guns by Countout after they did a fake-out title change with The Illegal Man, I think. Owen and Davey defeated Sid and Neidhart, who was replacing Ahmed, who had just been injured by Ron Simmons. And this is your main event. Shawn Michaels and Jose Lothario defeated Vader and Jim Cornette.
Wow. Yeah. Which that was actually supposed to be the original main event of the Mind Games pay-per-view.
Yeah, it was. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I guess Cornette was getting a lot of heat about booking himself in the main event, and they changed it, I think, was the story.
Yeah, which Mind Games was the week before this.
Yes.
You know, we were talking about, and had that great Shawn Mankind match. But yeah, and speaking of, you know, Raw, that was on the 30th, and it was taped the week before in Hershey. And here's the type of stuff that was going on there. We have Brian James as now the roadie, Jesse James, the real Double J. They're doing that whole deal. They're doing the Triple H and Mr. Perfect breakup. And you got these matches. You got Steve Austin going over Jake Roberts, which this is the one where Jerry Lawler spat alcohol in Jake's face. Okay?
Didn't that Jake say that it was real alcohol, too?
Yeah, which is funny because Jerry Lawler supposedly doesn't drink. All right? So you have that going on. You have the Godwins going over the Grimms. You had Savio going over Razor Ramon 2, and by DQ when Diesel 2 interfered. And this is where Gorilla Monsoon is on commentary, and Jim Ross is out there. And this is right at the beginning of the second week of that whole gimmick, and which we'll talk about that in a little bit. And then you have Vader and Jim Cornette going over Shawn and Jose Lothario. That's your main event of Raw. But Jim Ross on Raw said that he brought in real athletes to play Razor and Diesel, and it wasn't a billionaire Ted skit like McMahon came up with to make fun of people who are more successful than he is. Dave Meltzer says that last line was a surprise because it was almost an acknowledgement on the air on a WWF show that WCW had surpassed him. Mike, I remember the Razor Diesel gimmick. You know, Ross had got on the air and proclaimed that he was bringing them back home, and it was just a... It was a big deal because WCW had portrayed early on Scott and Kevin as basically Razor and Diesel, but they never called them by their names. Then, of course, they eventually would go by their real names. But the feeling was at the start that they were like WWF guys invading WCW. And I remember people at the time thinking, well, they're just coming back in.
Yeah, I mean
it was a screw job.
Yeah, I mean, I was 12 years old when they announced that. I remember they did it on that like that Friday Raw with the Shawn Michaels Goldust title match. They had the cut in with Ross saying, you know, making the announcement or whatever. And I mean, I really thought it was going to happen. I mean, I was 12. I didn't know any better. I was 12. I still, at the time, I was subscribing to The Observer. But still, like, I didn't, it wasn't until I got The Observer and Dave was like, yeah, this isn't happening, that I really did think it was, it seemed plausible.
Yeah, and then Ross was so gung-ho about it, and he really did a good job, you know, of getting it over. And
he was crapping on his performance on Twitter, like, I think it was this week. I think someone tweeted about it this week, and I kind of almost wanted to say to him, like, you actually did a good job. I mean, it was a bad idea, but he did a good job.
Well, what's funny about it is Ross said that he was patterning his character at the time after Jerry Jones, the owner of Dallas Cowboys, was, because at this time period, Jerry Jones was, he wasn't really like going rogue in the NFL, but he was. I mean, he was doing his own deals on the side, but he was always saying he was doing it for the betterment of the NFL. And Jim Ross was saying that he was, whatever he was doing was for the betterment of the World Wrestling Federation.
I remember that line. It was always the betterment of the WWF.
So, and Ross was playing it straight. He was being Jim Ross, except in at this deal, with this deal. Then he would go off on that man. And then it kind of went further a little bit. But this was, you know, really, you know, groundbreaking stuff for WWF to do on their television show. You know, to do these type of angles, because WWF was always, you know, by the book. And now, you know, ECW had appeared on Raw. Taz had appeared on Raw the week before. And he was, you know, back on this show. So now you had the you know, of course, today we're at the Mind Games pay-per-view in Philadelphia, Dreamer and Sandman. So you got that stuff going on. You got this Ross angle. I mean, WWF was doing some really interesting stuff at this time, Bix.
Yeah, and you know what? Honestly, maybe having Jim Ross be the guy was not the best idea, but if you're going to bring in other guys as Razor and Diesel to make a legal point, which was the reasoning behind this, having a heel say they're going to do it to get heat when he brings in some jabronis as Razor and Diesel is the best way to do it. If their lawyers are telling him that this is a good idea, I don't see another way they could have done it. Do you?
No. I mean, I think they did about the best way they could have. The problem was you had Rick Bogner playing Razor Ramon, and he was not good.
And I'll let you finish. Yeah.
But Glenn Jacobs came, played Diesel too, and people were impressed with how he portrayed the role. You know, he of course had been there as Isaac Yankum already, so people, they knew his face. Glenn Jacobs has a distinguished, you know, face. You know, you know what his face looks like. So that was kind of like an insulting the fan base in a way, but still, he actually did pretty good in the role.
Yeah, and it was the opposite of what everyone expected. Everyone came into this thinking, well, we've seen, you know, Rick Bogner sort of do the fake Razor thing in ECW, and we've seen him in FMW, and he seems like he's a pretty good worker, so he'll probably do pretty well. But Glenn Jacobs is kind of green and blah, 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 and he probably can't live up to being Diesel, which obviously in the end the point wasn't to live up to it, but still, then it turned out it was the opposite. Rick Bogner just didn't click. But for what you would want out of that role, Glenn Jacobs did really well, and this was kind of, this is fine. I think when he first started to find himself as a performer, I think even you could argue.
But this, they pretty much buried this angle just about, you know, the second or third weekend. It was over. I mean, it was completely over, and Ross eventually went back to normal. I mean, that was, they were just throwing stuff against the wall. Now, Vince was on the October 5th edition of Livewire, which that was the Saturday morning show. And this is what Dave had to say about this this appearance. Vince McMahon was on the show in a much-hyped appearance and basically said nothing. He used Doc Hendricks, our good friend Michael Hayes, to get over his usual storyline so that he didn't say anything bad about anyone. WCW lost millions of dollars, it's Ted Turner personal vendetta because again by WWF, etc. Although he did say Turner had a lack of business ethics. He came off bad in knocking Ross, saying that Ross was misrepresenting things and that he wasn't fired twice, that the first time his contract ran out and they chose not to renew it. Which Dave said reminded him of McMahon and Larry King saying that Mel Phillips had never been an employee of the World Wrestling Federation. He said the second time Ross was fired was for talking to the wrong people, and used Hendricks again to say, quote, stupid sheet writers, unquote, so he didn't have to say it.
I remember Ross, that line. I remember, yeah. Because it's like he made such a show out of it. It was so obviously not spur of the moment. It was so obviously rehearsed, and he did. It was just, I don't remember the context, but it was something like, blah, 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 stupid sheet writers. And he's like, yeah, I said it, stupid sheet writers. Nice yeah. Landell homage there.
Yeah. And Ross even brought up on Superstars the next day that the interview that got him fired, which was the interview with the Pro Wrestling Torch Talk, he'd done during a period where he wasn't even working for the WWF, which was the case, although the interview was printed after he was rehired. and WWF fired him because of it. All right, now we get to a fun little note. Livewire also introduced a new character named Vic Venom, who, of course, was Vince Russo, who has been doing the magazine and on television is basically doing a Mark Madden, quote, I'm a real journalist, unquote, gimmick.
Wow.
All right, here's what here's more Dave. A lot of people like the gimmick, but I thought he was getting in the way. A lot more Livewire is planted than I was aware of. As some, but probably not most of all of the calls that are supposed to be for fans are planted, as if you notice, the calls are usually about the subject that the particular segment is talking about. Anyway, I do know several calls that were supposed to be fans that were planted, but also they were very quick to hang up on people before asking a second question. So they're afraid of the non-plant callers asking questions they don't want to address or making silly remarks. Okay, here's what one of the most memorable things about this show. Paul Heyman called up as Bruce from Connecticut, and Sonny reacted as if it were her brother-in-law, which I guess is Zip and Skip are brothers, that if you mix wrestling storyline with reality, which many are prone to do, he is, as if in that entire state there's only one person named Bruce. Where that comes from, Bruce Pritchard. Zip was Tom Pritchard. There you go. And yelled at McMahon, saying he was copying all of his ideas from him, and screamed, shut the F up, so he didn't swear on television, as a cue to be cut off. Ross called and blamed McMahon for his Bell's palsy because of the stress McMahon put him through after McMahon and Venom were congratulating the WWF for being the only organization that had the guts to hire someone with Bell's palsy and put him on television. The show remains bad largely due to the quality of the questions and subjects being discussed. At one point, they mistakenly showed a computer screen as Sonny was talking about how the conversation in the chat room was favoring Vic Venom over McMahon. And then they showed the screen, and all that was there were comments apparently from little kids saying things like, hi, Sonny. I love you, Sonny. And I'm glad you dumped Skip.
That's great.
Even with the hype of McMahon being there to answer the charges by Ross, the show only did a 1.0 rating.
Oh, there are so many things to discuss about this.
Go ahead and start, Bix.
Okay. The one thing, and I was talking with Mike about this when we were looking at the notes, people don't remember or really ever talk about that when Paul calls in as Bruce from Connecticut, he actually does a Bruce Pritchard impression.
Yes!
And no one ever talks about that. It's actually good Bruce Pritchard impression. He actually sounds like him. So when it first, like, I remember watching, when they first did it, I thought they were actually doing an in-joke of Bruce Pritchard as a planted caller until he started talking as himself. And, but anyway, you know, that's, that of course is the thing everyone remembers. You know, the chat room stuff, I'm sure anyone who was on AOL at the time, whoever looked at the WWF area, remembers too. So then what else? Vic Venom.
Bix, is this the I believe Dominic Valente calls into this one where he asks Vince to why he has to have all these gimmicks. He's like, goes, Vince, you need to get rid of all these gimmicks. He goes, you know, that's Tom Brandy, that's not Salvatore Sincere.
Yeah,
okay,
Dominic.
I was going to mention Dominic, but I wasn't sure if it was this episode.
Yeah, and then I know, just going back to something that Chris said, is that Dominic used to call in every week, and then as the show was getting toward its end, like by the end of like '96, when I don't even think it was. They were live anymore. They were actually, Dominic says they were actually calling him and asking him to call in because they had no more callers left.
Mm.
They weren't even getting any calls at one point.
So should we explain who Dominic
Valente is? Yeah, I don't know how many people out there know who Dominic Valente is, but he's, a local New York hotline legend, I guess.
The free hotlines, and he's been around still, as a fan. And
he still emails me to this day.
Really?
And he still has his hotline. You know what? Actually, I know how we can introduce Dominic Valente to people. Give me 1 second.
Okay.
So, yes, his hotline still exists.
His hotline does still exist. Like, every once in a while, I'll just call it just to see, and sure enough, he still does it every single night.
Chris, vamp for a second. I have a surprise for everyone.
Okay. So, Vince Russo, I mean, I like the Vic Venom character because it was different. You know, WF hadn't done anything like that, and Russo was really good in that role. He came off as an annoying ass. I mean, he came off as a quintessential New Yorker.
Yeah.
And it really was a fun character to have on that show. And he was like, you know, talking inside and all this other stuff. You know, when you can see Michael Hayes and as Doc Hendricks, you know, didn't really want to go that way. And then you had Sonny there doing her like facial expressions, like, ooh, this is shocking.
And then, and then with Russo, of course, there was the thing eventually, like a couple months later, where he ruined the Royal Rumble.
Yes.
He said Brett was going to win, and they were so conscious of that stuff back then, they changed the finish.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that, I mean, I like Vince Russo in this character.
It was a, if you're going to use Vince Russo as a television character, it was a good use of Vince Russo as a television character.
Vince would have been, Vince Russo would have been a good heel manager.
I don't
know. With no power, as long as he went booking. He could have been a good heel manager.
Maybe.
I mean, because he really, I mean, he had that hatred about him. You wanted to punch him in the face.
Well, sure.
So that's what we got to, oh, do, did your little surprise work?
Yeah, let's see.
How you doing, wrestling fans? It's Sunday, October 4th. You're on a wrestling hot seat. This is Dominic. Today's wrestler's birthdays. First, let me introduce my broadcast partner, the Delzita from Long Island.
Hello, everybody. It's the Delzita from Long Island. What's the matter? You forgot about me over there? No, I'm going to keep going?
No, my mind drifted.
You motherfucker.
All right, today's wrestler's birthdays. We got Bobby Fulton, old-time star Dick Hutton, the legendary Chief J. Strongbow. We got Silver Star. We got Otto Schwartz, who's also Bo Depp. Emi Matokoya from Japan. Heavy Metal from Mexico. Linda McMahon. And it's also, yesterday's birthday was Mikey Batts, who had a run in WWE and in TNA. It's also a very good friend of mine, John Pantosi's birthday. He's a ring announcer, been a timekeeper and everything else. Going to call him later, wish him a happy birthday. Celebrity birthdays, Jackie Collins, Anne Rice, Charlton Heston, Buster Keaton, the gorgeous Susan Sarandon, Alicia Silverstone, and Armand Asante. Today in wrestling history, October 4th, 1993, Jeff Jarrett defeated Wildfire Tommy Rich, Memphis, Tennessee, to win for...
Okay, I'm done.
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, that when he was talking about Mikey Batts, he should have been talking about Billy Batts. Because, I mean, it basically sounded like we were in Goodfellas at that time period. Oh, it was awesome.
I first discovered that hotline, I want to say, in like 95 or 96.
Yeah, me too. Well, no, it was when he replaced Ben Lagerstrom endorsed him.
Right.
Just because Ben, because there were all these, what was the name of the company that gave away those voicemail boxes?
Oh, I don't remember, but there was definitely a point when everybody had one. I mean,
there were
he had
tons
one.
Of these.
So Tony Lewis of Strictly ECW had one, and these people would update it. I mean, every night they would do.
Well,
I called
Joe Pedicino. Joe Pedicino had one through the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, little hotline deal. Right, so I would call Pedicino's. Yeah,
and Brett Schwan had one at one point.
RFIDO had one in Philly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big thing at the time period because, you know, internet was just starting to gain traction. But a lot of people did not have internet in 1996.
No,
yeah.
And so you had these the free fan hotlines, and you also had Talking Yellow Book, too.
Yeah,
God. Did you get Talking Yellow Book in Atlanta?
No, but I remember it.
You know what we're talking? It was the phone. So what was the phone company or the Yellow Pages that would operate it, I guess? And
yeah.
They'd have ads, and they'd have different people doing different stuff, and one of them was a wrestling news hotline. And
yeah, just crazy.
I think Coach Kurt was involved in it at one point, but eventually gave it up. Like he was, he's the only notable I remember being involved.
But God, that segment, oh, I love that.
Dominic Valenti. He still does it every day. He's still up to it's now 20 years. He's had.
I mean, and that's not fake, folks. That is real deal, right there.
You
real
know,
deal
I
attack.
Give out the number. I could give out the number. It's not like it's free for anyone.
Yeah, that's true.
Especially everyone has free long distance now. It's 212-629-1900.
Yeah, so
you don't really have to get your parents' permission because your parents have free long distance.
Dominic's going to see that he got like a bump in calls and wonder what the hell happened.
A couple of months ago, John Orezzi was on Wade Keller's Torch Talk.
Oh, God, and Dominic called in, yes.
And Dominic called in, and he's like, he's pretending like he's not going to say his name at first. He's like, I want John to guess who this is. I'm one of his oldest, longest friends. And John Orezzi knew right away it was Dominic. He goes, this is Dominic Valenti.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, anyway, back to Jim Ross. Jim Ross, for the work he's doing in this angle, was named Vice President of Wrestling Administration, and Bruce Pritchard was named Vice President of Talent Relations, taking J.J. Dillon's spot on October the 4th. They are using the Ross job promotion in the angle, claiming that Dillon gave him the job and a no-cut contract before leaving, but that he had kept his secret until this past week.
I don't remember that at all.
I don't either.
That must have been a hotline thing or something.
So, wow, that's something else. To wrap a bow on that, on the whole angle, because we're about to talk about some other things. Yeah, Jim Ross, of course, would eventually... How long would it be before he took over the talent relations job?
Not long, I don't think.
And that changed...
No, wait a second. He was already... Wasn't he already officially running talent relations because he brought in Foley, right?
Yeah, I thought he was doing it by, like, when he came back in early 95. That was what he came in for.
Yeah, but they removed him from that position, didn't they? I don't know.
No, wait, wait. I guess JJ was still running the department, but Ross must have been working at talent relations, though.
He had to have been, but, it's, you know, Bruce was the guy in charge. I do know that for sure. He was the guy in charge. And then, Ross became the guy after that, and that's, promotion pretty much changed after that. So, yeah, it's just interesting to go back and look at WWF 1996, because it's a different world. And another reason why it's a different world is WWF and Dennis Corluzzo, that's right, the legendary NWA promoter in New Jersey, had worked at a talent agreement where Corluzzo would use WWF talent that needed seasoning, such as Dwayne Johnson, Mark Henry, Akim Albrecht, the legendary Brakus, etc., to give them experience, but that has already fallen through due to the ECW angle. Now, Bix, I want you to explain why that fell through due to ECW.
Dennis Corluzzo and Paul Heyman and I guess Todd Gordon, who isn't involved anymore, had heat going back the last couple of years over... I guess it went back, because we talked about this 2 weeks ago, I think, right? Because of the NWA thing, right? I think that's where it all started.
Were getting there. We haven't done that yet. Yeah.
That was where it all started, right?
Was the NWA it was over the NWA thing, and then, of course, the tournament.
Well, they were both NWA promoters, and that's where the heat started, because they're really running the same market. I mean, because Dennis mostly ran South Jersey. He didn't run North Jersey, so he's basically running Philly. And they eventually agreed, NWA Eastern Championship Wrestling would only run Pennsylvania and NWA New Jersey would only run New Jersey. And then there was the whole thing with the throwing the belt down and blah, 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 and things got more heated. And, they ran big shows opposite each other that one night, especially opposite the tournament. It was the night of the tournament, the Candido one, that it was opposite the ECW show with the WCW guys. And, they just had heat and... So, of course, the ECW angle led to heat with Dennis. Although, Dennis ended up booking WWF guys on off days, though, for a while. I mean, it's not like he didn't have a relationship. I mean, he was using, Goldust he used at the next Double Memorial, I think. So, I guess this went up in flames. It's not like they didn't have a relationship anymore. Although, Brakus did go to ECW.
Yeah. Now, Mike, have you gone to any Corluzzo shows?
I hadn't. No, I was too young at that time. Mostly just attended up until the late 90s. I mostly only attended WWF shows.
Now, Corluzzo shows were interesting. I have seen some of them on tape before. I mean, he used that same crew of guys, but that late 90s Northeast indie scene was like worlds different than the indie scene would be in the New York area like 3 years later.
Oh, God, yes.
Like we had Derek Domino and God, who else was working?
Ace Darling, Devin Storm. Why am I forgetting his name? Also, the guy who always Billy Real. I was gonna say the guy who always
Glenn Osborne was around.
Nova was one of your top work rate stars.
Oh my God, what a terrible era.
You had some interesting things. I mean, you had like guys who were originally from the area who were in the big two would still work indie shows. So you had Kidman. So you had some interesting stuff. Oh, that was, I think that stopped once he turned babyface, right? Once he left the block. So he stopped working indie shows. But I mean, you had some interesting stuff, but really from like the whole, late 99, the whole period that kind of really starts in late 99, mid 2000, whatever you want to call it, and then really starts peaking with ROH. I mean, it's so close in proximity to your, you know, Cheetah Master, Lance Diamond, Ace Darling, Devin Storm type of stuff, but even though it seems so far apart.
It was really the coming about of, you know, Homicide and all his guys.
Homicide, you know, Loki were like the beginning.
Yeah, you know, and
Jersey All Pro got hot.
Mm-hmm.
Jersey All Pro got hot. CZW got hot because they were doing that different style. And, of course, ECW was expanding out. So,
and, you know, actually, you know what I would say, though? Between ECW closing, I would say that you can make an argument that that anti-hardcore extreme wrestling bill probably benefited Jersey All Pro and CZW in the long term.
Oh, CZW, totally. It made them change.
CZW had to do different stuff on the New Jersey shows, and Jersey All Pro had to completely make over the promotion.
Yeah, it made them change. You're exactly right. And that was a controversial thing at the time. But that's a whole nother show. My favorite story in this whole section is this one. WF got a ton of local publicity in Calgary on October the 5th as they had $1 off every ticket, which was given to the Alberta Children's Hospital in the name of Matthew Annis, the nephew of Brett Owen and Davey Boy Smith, who died over the summer. Matthew's 16-year-old brother, Ted, teamed with Harry Smith, the 11-year-old son of Davey Boy, to beat 16-year-old T.J. Wilson and Andrew Picarnia and the opener on the Calgary show. The crowd gave the four a nice ovation. Dave was told they looked good doing their spots, but they were told to go home earlier than was originally planned and out of nowhere, so it didn't build for a finish. Dave said some things never change. The event got front page coverage in the local press, and as expected, Owen and Davey were over as babyface against the Godwins since both live in Calgary. Now, one report Dave got was that the kids' match was the best match on the entire show, with Ted Annis doing a moonsault and a superplex, and Harry Smith doing a Randy Savage elbow off the top. The four worked a good AAA-style match for 8 minutes. One of the agents, though, complained they were exposing the business, however, I guess by having such a good match. Anyway, the people liked it. Now, Mike, of course, Ted Annis would go on to become the legendary Teddy Hart, one of my all-time favorites. And I think this is so awesome that they had an 11-year-old Harry Smith working a match on the show.
Last year I've heard so much about that match, too, because I know TJ talked about it on Jericho's podcast, I think,
in a lot of
detail. It's kind of taken on a life of its own. It's a shame that there's no tape of it, as if it happened today, to be on YouTube immediately, right?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I still can't believe you hadn't heard of it till you reread this.
Who, me?
Yeah.
I completely forgot about it. Yeah, I completely forgot that this happened.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's crazy. And, God, Teddy Hart.
Yeah, wasn't the story TJ tells is that, like, Teddy used someone's finisher during the match, right?
Yeah, Big Sugar. How'd it go? Because you were relating it to me, because I haven't listened to the Jericho podcast.
Okay, so what I believe what happened was that he did the superplex, and Barry Windham's also on the card.
Yes.
And Windham kind of tried to nicely, you know, talk to him about it. And Teddy basically talked to him the way you would expect Teddy to, saying, and God, I don't want to do the Teddy voice because I know I'll butcher it, but I also feel like I kind of have to, so... He was like, well, you do a superplex from the second rope. I've never seen you do it from the top rope. So it's really a different move. And, Yeah, I know that was terrible, but I felt I had to at least give part of the Teddy experience.
Teddy Hart would be like, Barry Windham, you do your superplex off the middle rope, not the top rope.
That's exactly what you would expect him to say if you didn't know.
I'm Ted Hart. Let's go to Disney World. I have the Hart pass. But I mean, that's just awesome. That sounds like a Holy Grail type thing. You know, it's an 8-minute match. That sounds like Holy Grail material.
I mean, if you've seen Mat Rats, that stuff was not necessarily the best in terms of psychology and transitions, to say the least. So I can.
Well, if you're watching that, you're not watching.
No, but it looked like backyard wrestling, so I can only imagine what it looks like with all of them 5 years younger.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, if you're watching that type of stuff, you're not watching for mat work and, you know, guys in there selling and working, you know, like that. You're expecting total spot fest, you know. So
also, just think of the difference in times. Like that something like that would never in a million years happen in today's WWE.
Oh, God, yes,
kids to work a house show.
No, they wouldn't be allowed to do that. I'm sure
11-year-old kids who have been learning how to take bumps in the ring that Matt Annis got an infection and died from.
Right.
I mean, that I believe is the theory on how he died. Right? Wasn't that in Brett's book?
Yeah.
That he got a cut in Stu's ring.
Yeah.
And that got the bacteria. So yes, that they were working in a ring that literally killed their friend, cousin, brother, etc., to prepare for this match.
Wrestling, folks. Yep. All right. In the last story in the WWF section, we have this is another great one. The Cauliflower Alley Club ran a banquet run in New York, New Jersey on October the 5th, which was the first one of these events attended by Vince McMahon and his family. So it was WWF heavily oriented. There's an irony in that because for years, WWF and CAC had nothing to do with each other. In fact, in 1991... the CAC ran its banquet in Los Angeles, which by coincidence was the day before WrestleMania at the Sports Arena. And there wasn't one WWF person at the banquet. And
those who... Well, should we tell the story about that?
Well, go ahead. Let me finish sure. And you can get it. And those who wanted to go were discouraged or swerved from doing so. But times change. McMahon was there to accept an award for his late father, while also awarding to the CAC Hall of Fame, where Tony Cosenzo, Dominic DiNucci, Afa, Jimmy Snuka, Killer Kowalski, Kurt Hennig, and Sonny. Now in attendance were Arnold Skolin, Chris Candido, Tom and Bruce Pritchard, Pat Patterson, Shane McMahon, of course, Lou Thesz, former promoter Abe Coleman, Freddie Blassie, Davey O'Hannon, Tommy Cairo, Ted Lewin, Lou Albano, Red Bastien, Carl Von Hess, Billy Darnell, Ray Stern, Dennis Coraluzzo, Jim Kettner, Ace Darling, which that doesn't surprise me, Kodiak Bear, Gino Caruso, Tom Brandy, and some guy named Dwayne Johnson, and a bodybuilder, soon-to-be wrestler, Achim Albrecht.
Note the spelling of Dwayne Johnson here, too.
Yeah, D-U-A-N-E. Now, Achim Albrecht blew everyone away with the size of his shoulders. So that's something to mention. Reports were that it was largely uneventful other than the McMahon appearance. Although there were lots of complaints regarding Albano's behavior, some even said Albano ruined the entire evening. The Conan O'Brien show was there, trying to make fun of the festivities, asking the wrestlers questions about politics, because this, of course, was the 1996 presidential election, and Andy Richter was there doing the questions. And I remember that being a really funny little skit. But first off, Biz, go ahead and tell your Los Angeles story.
Well, it was that, Dave Meltzer's told this one a few times now, that Stu Hart was there, for WrestleMania, and he wanted to go to Cauliflower Alley to see Buddy Rogers, because he hadn't seen him in decades, I think, something like that, and someone gave him the wrong directions, because there was the weird, unnecessary heat that was being talked about there, and he never saw Buddy Rogers, and Buddy Rogers died the following year. So, yes, what a stupid thing to have heat about, too.
But that's Vince.
This is pretty, even by the standards of wrestling pettiness, that was pretty bad. And I remember the Conan thing. It was Andy Richter was there. I don't remember being quite as making fun of it as much as this made it sound like it would be. Do you?
I thought it was a funny segment. I mean,
but I don't think it was as.
It was what you would expect.
But it wasn't as disrespectful as it sounds here.
No, it wasn't disrespectful. It's what you would expect.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. But, Mike, you look at the list of people that were honored. It's WWF heavy. And, it makes total sense because they're in the area. Vince is there. But Lou Albano making a scene of himself.
Yeah.
What a shock, huh?
Yeah, that doesn't sound very surprising. I mean, especially during that time period. It's funny because, like, if you look back to the mid-90s, WWF really didn't care about its past. Like, you didn't really see them bringing legends around all that often or guys that they considered, Hall of Famers. He was, like, the one guy, though, who was always around. They'd always have him on TV. He'd show up on, Livewire or, like, the syndicated shows just to do a ringing, commentating for a random match and things like that. But then once they actually started, like, caring about, like, their past and the Hall of Fame, you really never saw him again. Like, that was the strange part. When they actually started, like, bringing around a lot of the older guys and, like, you know, bringing back the Hall of Fame and things. Like, I don't know, maybe he was just, he got older and he was sick or whatever, or, like, maybe they realized that he was an embarrassment, but you never saw him again. He was the one guy in the 90s, but then by the 2000s, you never saw him.
Well, they would bring back Blassie, you know, and Ernie Ladd would make appearances every now and then.
But it wasn't like today, you know?
No. Definitely not like today. And, yeah, it's just a different time and place. But Cauliflower Alley in New Jersey, that's interesting to me, though.
There's a tape of that Cauliflower Alley that I've seen. And when Vince does the acceptance speech, he seems like incredibly moved during it. I mean, you know, Vince is a good actor, so you just never know. But he was like, his speech is really something if you've ever seen the tape of it.
Is this the only time they ever came to the East Coast, by the way?
I think so. That's why I said it's weird that they were in New Jersey. But regarding Vince was always emotional when he talked about his father.
Yeah.
I mean, remember the Madison Square Garden Hall of Fame deal. You know, Vince was emotional at that speech. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, that's one thing about Vince. You know, him talk about his dad. You know, you'll see more of a real sincerity from Vince that you don't see much about anywhere else.
Yeah, he seemed really moved by the whole thing.
Yeah. Also, when you're looking at the guest list, I mean, it's like, it's almost like a reverse Cauliflower Alley. You know what I mean? Because usually it's all these West Coast people.
Yeah.
But here you have Davey O'Hanlon, you know, except for, you know, the people who are part of Cauliflower Alley, like Red Bastien and, you know, Luthez.
And, of course, Sonny got a Future Legend Award.
Was that the first year they did that?
I think so.
So, yeah, well, so that was the beginning.
She's a legend, all right, in Skype. She's a Skype legend, no doubt. Follow her on Twitter if you want to see what you're missing on the Skype deal, because she posts little preview pics. And
I
remember the picture of her with that award was like in the After magazines for months and months. I mean, that was like the one picture they just kept using at the time. I guess like it was a good photo shoot for those magazines at the time.
Yeah, but it's like I'm trying to figure out who would be the West Coast equivalent to Tommy Cairo.
In that era or any era?
Just in that era. Vern Langdon? I don't know.
Wow. I don't know who would be in that era.
Yeah, I don't think I can't think of it. Like, Davey O'Hanlon.
Ricky Ataki?
Yes, that's perfect. That's perfect. And Davey O'Hanlon.
Rock Riddle?
Like Rock Riddle. No, I was thinking Davey O'Hanlon would be the Rock Riddle.
Yeah, he'd be the Rock Riddle. All right, now we're moving on to All Japan Pro Wrestling. And this plays off something that we talked about on a recent show. As Hiroshi Hase, who is currently a sitting Japanese senator representing the Kanazawa district, announced to Tokyo Sports on September 29th that he would be leaving New Japan and would be starting for All Japan in January. Now, Tokyo Sports had reported of his negotiations days earlier, so Hase had to come out and confirm the story that he met with AJPW President Giant Baba on September 9th and September 19th. And in that last meeting, Baba agreed that Hase could join All Japan, with Hase then meeting with New Japan later that day to tell them of his decision before it leaked to the press. Now, Baba was asked about it at the September 20th Cork and Hall show, and he laughed it off, saying that all he knew was that what the magazines were reporting, and that he has never met with Hase. Hase is serving a 6-year term, which expires in 2001, so he would basically become a part-time wrestler. Hase and New Japan had a falling out over the last year after the death of one of his top proteges, Gompei, that's all the name that everybody had, who took some hard bumps on his head on his second day of training after some hard negotiations with Gompei's family, and passed out before dying not too long after. New Japan gave Gompei an elaborate funeral and ran a benefit show for him, but Gompei's parents or Hase never got what they felt was the true story behind his passing. Hase was diligent in trying to get the truth, but the promotion would just say there was an unfortunate situation and everyone should just move on. Nothing to see here.
On which
Hase felt was bullshit. And New Japan even tried to smooth things over with Hase by holding a huge show in Kanazawa in July, with Hase in the main event right as his contract as a consultant was about to expire, figuring that Hase's questions would be stopped, but it didn't. Hase was also upset New Japan promoted this Tokyo Dome match on January 4th and his Kanazawa match as his retirement matches when he wasn't ready to retire. Hase's plans in All Japan are that he would train in the dojo, preparing for his in-ring return, and admitted that he is in the worst shape of his life, but he wants to get in good enough shape where he could have a match early in 1997 before coming back for another match in July. And Biggs, we talked about the Gompei situation before. I say it's an interesting jump. He hadn't been, really been doing much with New Japan lately, as we talked about, but it's a guy with a big name going over, which was, at this time period, you know, it wasn't really happening.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, what was the when was the last time it happened? The not all the 1990 stuff?
Yeah, that would be the last real major jump, I would say.
I mean, and you had a bunch that year, because, I mean, some were jumps, some weren't, because some were the...
Yeah, a lot of cross-promotional. Yeah, yeah, a lot of cross-promotional stuff.
But even among liner names, like, I think 1990 is when Johnny Smith jumped, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so it just you had a lot that year. You had the SWS stuff.
Dr. Death jumped.
All right, you had the co-promotion. Dr. Death started as a co-promotion, but then jumped. So, yeah, I mean, it was... that was the end of it for a long time.
And 1996 is really, that's one of the peak years of New Japan, right? In terms, in terms of business.
Yeah, it was a huge year for them. And Hase was basically a consultant. He really wasn't Choshu's assistant booker anymore. But, you know, with Hase as assistant booker, I mean, that was some of the best booking ever,
yeah,
you know, of any wrestling promotion in that era. And that's a big blow. And New Japan, you know, without Hase there later on and Choshu became the main guy really all alone, the product took a downward turn.
It's Dominic Valenti calling you. yeah, and I guess when you I'm trying to think when... Like, he wasn't... I mean, he wasn't working... Like, was he providing suggestions or anything in 96? Because I feel like... I'm just trying to figure out, like, what, like, the change did of things turning, getting worse, the product, didn't really happen until 97. And I'm just trying to think, was that just Choshu running out of his own ideas, or what?
It could be Choshu running out of his own ideas, and also the guys were getting older. I mean, you know, well, those guys are on the way down, Muda, Chono. And they started doing the 97. They relied heavily on the NWO stuff.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, I also think about, well, yeah, I guess it was Choshu's stuff was still kind of okay, because I mean the junior, I think of the juniors going downhill in 97, but that wasn't really Choshu anyway.
Yeah, well, that was Liger. Liger was the guy really in charge of the juniors at that time period.
Yeah, and but yeah, as far as Hase, he comes off good here, and then New Japan, and comes off absolutely terrible.
Yeah, and him in All Japan was just a cool little touch, because he had some cool matches there, and yeah, it was just it added to them. And of course, you know, once they brought in like guys like Vader, as you know, the end of the 90s came on, it gave a, you know, it kind of broke up the monotony of the top match scene at the time,
which was
yeah, I mean. Especially like by late 96, I mean, All Japan needed something. I mean, it was just the same stuff over and over at that point.
And they were lose Furnace and Crawford to WWF because Baba promised he'd bring them up to the main events and then Renee.
Exactly, yeah.
And we're about to talk about that in a second. The September 29th Cork and Hall show, which they ran a doubleheader, was the 36th anniversary of the pro wrestling debut of Giant Baba. So Baba worked the main event, teaming with Toshiaki Kawada and Akira Taue to beat Mitsuharu Misawa, Kenta Kobashi, and Tamon Honda in 28:35 when Taue used a dynamic bomb on Honda. They did an angle during the match to build up the Kobashi versus Kawada Triple Crown match, where Kobashi dropped Kawada on his head and knocked him out. Usually, it's been Kawada dropping Kobashi on his head. But Dave guesses, since even though Kobashi is champion, he's going into the title match as the underdog. So they did the traditional angle in reverse. Now, Mike, the Kawada Kobashi matches were fantastic. And one thing about this scene in All Japan, though, is this is the head dropping is really starting to get prevalent there at this time period.
Yeah, and I think 97 is probably the worst year for it. We're getting close to it, but 97 is like the year where we get that Misawa Kawada match where they just drop. It's like the entire match is literally just Kawada dropping Misawa on his head over and over and over again. And yeah, by like we said, that by 96, by the end of 96, it was just it was feeling like a really tired promotion. We were getting the same matches over and over, and they didn't know what to do, so they just kept trying to up the ante and up the ante and up the ante until it was like there's no more higher you can really go before without killing someone. So
I feel like 99 is more when it really maybe 96, 97 is when it started to get out of control. 99 is when it was became clear that it had become way too far out of control.
I think
with the Gonzo bomb and stuff.
When did business really start going down for them, though? I think it was like 97. I mean, they were on that sellout streak forever.
I think it was like late 97, early 98. Does that sound right, Chris?
Yeah, because they had sold out every Budokan for all those years, and then it was...
Yeah. Yeah, I would say 98-ish would have been a good time period, but you talk about the head dropping. Vix, do you think that the head dropping, if they cut it off and limited it down, how would it affect the careers of Kawada, Misawa, Kobashi? Would it gave them more time as healthy performers, because they became pretty much physical wrecks in the 2000s?
I think it gives them more time. I mean, they were already... It's still a hard style, so probably not quite as much time as we'd think. But, look, if we're going to be blunt about it, Misawa probably doesn't die. I think it helps. I don't see any way it wouldn't help.
Another thing that probably would help is if the guys actually would take time off when they had injuries. I mean, if you look like... as these guys are getting more hurt, 96, 97, it's like, it gets to the point 98 where Masao was hurt really, really bad, and he's going to take a couple of months off, and then the next thing you know, he's back because business is down. So those guys just would not take any time off.
That was the beginning of that with All Japan and then Noah, because when you think back, Misawa, those guys used to miss tours all the time, or at least parts of tours all the time. I mean, it was not unusual for a guy to get injured and bow out, and then it just changed, and they really had some. They really did put on some amazing matches still during this time. But even if you get rid of the head drops, I love the. It's in a way it's not as good as some of their more famous matches, but I love the dome match with Kawada and Misawa. I love the Kobashi Kawada title change in 98.
Yeah, that Kobashi Kawada. That's one of the 98 Kobashi Kawada. That's one of the last really really great Old Japan Triple Crown matches.
Yeah, I also even like the Kobashi Akiyama match the month later.
The month later, yeah, both of those.
Those are two really good back-to-back matches. And they're also not two head droppy or anything either. Those are just two really great matches. And
yeah.
After that, I think what makes me feel with the head dropping, just think about it being so far over the top, that January 99 Masao Kawada with the Gonzo Bomb, until that weird finish where Misawa just kicks out of that and they just do it for no reason, and then Kawada hits the two brainbusters and pins him, that's one of their best matches up to that point, too.
Yeah.
And for reasons having nothing to do with the head dropping. It's like, they're becoming smarter workers, too, and putting together really great matches much of the time, but they just felt the need to keep raising the bar and raising the bar.
Yeah, exactly. Now, we had talked about the morale. The situation here has greatly changed now when it comes to foreign morale. A few years back, the regulars here saw working for All Japan as being the best regular job in wrestling. The pay was good, and you had 24 to 30 weeks off per year and a great deal of normal stress associated with wrestling. Constant fear of being swerved and career being buried by poor booking, lying from the office, and constant travel really didn't exist. Those who headlined here didn't want to be anywhere else. It's noted by the fact that Stan Hansen in his prime was one of the top heels and the workers in the world. And while he had short stints elsewhere, he never gave up Japan since he knew he had the best position around. Ditto people like Terry Gordy and Steve Williams, who as big men could work here, were constantly the type of wrestlers the top American offices wanted as regulars. Anyway, it has changed, and a lot of the talent sees both WWF and WCW constantly looking for new talent that Dave said, in most cases, would use up as TV fodder, but that's another story. And willing to pay well for it, combined with the fact that All Japan fans have seen everything, the booking has become stale. And that the fact is that the top guys have beaten each other to death, and none are what they once were. And Dave said Jun Akiyama would be the lone exception, because he was the younger guy, who would even then only be figured to work the big shows. Things are going to get worse before they get better. Prophetic words from young Dave Meltzer. It's very true, Mike. I mean, we saw Furnace and Crawford is a perfect example. You know, they were a big deal in all Japan, and then they come to America, you know, work for ECW first. I mean, Paul does pretty good by them. They go WWF and boom.
Yeah. Yeah, that run didn't last long at all, did it?
No. And then one guy, though, that never left, and I'm pretty sure there's reasons for that, was John Laurinaitis, Johnny Ace.
Yep.
And Biggs, I'm pretty sure that he had those extra benefits that was keeping him bound to Japan, wouldn't you think?
It depends on your preferences.
Well, hey, you know, whatever it takes, you know.
I mean, that Motoko Baba, I mean, if you look at her from certain angles, she looks an awful lot like Kathy Collet.
Oh, God.
Oh, man.
Oh, wow. But, you know, this is the type here where guys like, was it Wolf Hawkfield? You know, Jim Steele was becoming a regular. I mean,
he was not bad, though. I mean, he became a perfectly solid hand.
Yeah, he was okay, but it was a totally different type of scene in the early 90s as far as the Gaijin was going.
Well, and now, there was gone or about to leave.
Yeah, and, you know, we got two guys who we'll talk about in a little bit who would have go to All Japan that, you know, were way different than anything All Japan had seen, so as far as Americans. But
would that be Sabu and Gary Albright?
That'd be Sabu and Rob Van Dam.
Oh, yeah.
So we'll talk, you know, we'll talk about them in a few minutes.
Van Dam's already there at this point, isn't he?
Van Dam's been there for a while, yeah.
Yeah.
But he's getting a little bit more of a push, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's just, it's definitely not the normal King's Road type of style, you know?
Right. He's an All Japan junior heavyweight in the 90s, though. I mean, it doesn't really matter, right?
Yeah, but the All Japan Junior Heavyweight scene is nowhere near what New Japan's Junior Heavyweight scene.
No, but it was also kind of underrated, too. I mean,
underrated, but it's way different.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, but Van Damme, you could even argue, was in the best All Japan Junior Heavyweight match of the 90s, too. I mean, it's either him against Crawford or the famous Fuchi match.
Yeah.
Now, moving on to Big Japan. That's right, we got some Big Japan here. At their show in Omiya on September 30th, they invited New Japan wrestlers to show up as they are starting an angle.
Oh, God, that's right. The forgotten New Japan interpromotional angle.
Yeah, the promotion sent four members of their front office instead to meet Big Japan president Shinya Kojika, and the Big Japan guys will be feuding with Hayashi and Shingun. The main event of this show is a great one, as Mitsuharu Matsunaga, the legendary Mr. Danger, defeated Shoji Nakamaki. And this is the stipulation of this match: a chandelier, broken glass, drum cabinet, barbed wire baseball bat, no rope, barbed wire street fight, double hell death. That's right.
That's
great. Mike, Nakamaki is a guy who, I mean, I knew Matsunaga from other promotions, but Nakamaki was a guy I first really paid attention to because he was spotlighted on the Insane Clown Posse Strangle Mania.
That's right.
Commercial tape as they called him Lama Namanumi. And for anybody that hasn't seen Strangle Mania, you got to see that tape because ICP is fantastic on that. But talk about the deathmatch scene in the 90s and from your perspective. I know we've talked about it on the show. I mean, it was a really big deal among the tape traders.
Oh, well, definitely. And it's definitely, it's probably, you know, the with FMW obviously being the biggest one, and that's, you know, but that's what ECW was. If you watched ECW, like, you wanted to get tapes of FMW and Wing and Big Japan because it was that much more hardcore than ECW ever was. So I remember going to ECW shows, and like, that was always the big seller on Feinstein's table. Was he had all the FMW tapes and that Wing and that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, ECW never came close to the level of violence that those promotions were doing in the 90s. And really, like, no one's, I mean, Big Japan is still around, and they still do their one, like, big death match a show, but it's nothing now compared to what it was back then. I mean, there were so many promotions doing it in the 90s.
Oh, FMW was, you know, doing huge business. I mean, doing stadium shows.
Yeah.
Although we're about to talk about another promotion, though, that wasn't doing so great, but yeah, it was a Wing, of course. I mean, it was a boom period.
Yeah.
And American tape trading fans were eating it up. Bitch, you know. I mean, look at all the comp tapes that had all that type of stuff on there.
Oh, yeah. And I remember, like, I'm thinking about even like, as you're talking about FMW, and Mike was talking about FMW being the big seller of the ECW shows. I mean, I think that our friend Wes, like, I knew him back, going back to, like, 97, 98. I remember FMW being, like, the first Japanese tapes he really got into as a big ECW guy.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Feinstein's biggest selling tapes during those late 90s period was all FMW and that kind of stuff.
Well, other than ECW. I think ECW.
Other than ECW, obviously, yeah.
Yeah, it's just it was a time and a place deal, you know. One of those things, it fit perfectly for the time
period.
Well,
FMW holds now, pretty well, though.
It does, but
the rest, not as much. FMW holds up well.
Now, the Big Japan New Japan feud was, you know, what it was. It was an undercard deal. It was Hayashi Shingun, you know, Shiro Koshinaka, and all that crew. So.
Well, and it introduced a lot of people to Tajiri, though.
Yeah, and it was, you know, they had a big match on the Dome show. On the January 4th Dome show. So, yeah, I mean, it was what it was. It was getting the Big Japan out there. So, I mean,
weren't there a few matches on the Dome show? Wasn't it like a best 3 out of 5 or 2 out of 3 series with New Japan?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was an elimination match. It was a series. That's right. You're right. Now, on October 3rd, IWA Japan, which that was one of the big hardcore groups at the time, their owner, Kishio Asano, announced that the group will be running its final tour and close up after their October 12th show. The way the story was reported in Japan is that the group's top star, Tarzan Goto, told Asano that he and his proteges, Mr. Ganosuke and Flying Kid Ichihara, would be leaving the group to join Tokyo Pro Wrestling. Asano realized that without them, his promotion couldn't continue and asked him to stay for the final tour, at which time the promotion would close its doors. Whether it actually happened that way or not is subject to speculation. After losing much of his top-drawing foreign talent, in particular Terry Funk, Cactus Jack, who won that big deathmatch tournament, the Headhunters, largely due to Asano having a falling out with Booker Victor Quiñones, who then went to work for FMW, taking Funk and the Headhunters with him, while Jack ended up working for FMW as well before him going full-time with WWF, the most recent IWA Japan tour, which drew poorly, had a foreign talent list consisting of, this is a great list, Leatherface, Rick Patterson, Tommy Wildfire Rich, Doug Gilbert as Freddy Krueger, and Dr. Luther, Lynn St. Clair,
who was just at the Garden. Just saw last night, yeah.
At the Garden Show, yeah, looking old. Along with Mexican wrestlers Mr. Niebla and Pirata Morgan Jr., along with valet Miss Patricia.
Of ECW fame.
Yeah, ECW short-time fame. As they were building up an interpromotional grudge match between Goto and War's Hiromichi Fuyuki. That's quite a far cry markability-wise from the biggest show in company history, which included Funk, Jack, Dan Severn, Tiger Jeet Singh, Terry Gordy, Headhunters, Silver King, and El Tejano. Now, IWA Japan, Bix, they would come back in different incarnations.
With Mr. Asano, though.
But it was nowhere near the level of what they once were. I mean, they ran the Kawasaki Stadium and drew a huge house, like, you know, we talked about. And some of those matches are on that Stranglemania commercial tape.
Yeah.
Just a month earlier, they had done the shows with ECW, too, the TV taping that aired in the United States.
That's right.
That's right. With the ECW International Tag Team Champions, the Eliminators.
Yes.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, I mean, they came back. When did they come back exactly? What was that, 99?
99, I know for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, it was fun. I mean, there was a lot of fun stuff.
With Terry Gordy. In 1999.
And who was it that eventually became Booker? Jim Duggan?
Duggan booked, you know, in the 2000s.
The tournament where he brought in all his Mid-South friends and stuff. And
Bubba, Dr. Death.
Yeah, I mean, I liked the stuff like with the... I liked Asian Cougar as Kappa Kozu. And then his mini Kappa Jr. But that... I mean, there was some fun stuff happening there still, but...
It was Dr. Death, though. It was Dr. Death booking, not...
Yes, that's right. It was Dr. Death booking, and he brought Duggan in. With Duggan's wife as his valet.
Yes.
But it was never close to the same after the original one. I mean, I was going to say it was like Wing and then the second version of Wing, but Wing never got as big as IWA did.
Yeah, exactly. Now, this time period is like the beginning of that boon of the indies in Japan. I mean, you have new indies popping up. You have the other indies starting to get big. I mean, the days of just All Japan and New Japan being the dominant force in Japan are, you know, coming to an end. I mean, you got all these promotions running around. It's a crazy time.
Well, what do you think? A lot of that had to do with the kind of like the start of Samurai TV later in '96.
So, yeah,
like,
Samurai TV, of course, was starting up not too long after this week.
Because now, everyone has TV for the first time and on a legit station. As like you know, FMW before Samurai TV had just the 1 hour the show on.
Well, Champs, it was still
Champs Forum. Yeah, same thing with Michinoku Pro, but then Samurai TV starts, and all of a sudden Michinoku Pro has, you know, multiple hours a month, FMW, Big Japan's got TV. So it's like, oh, this outlet is there now for all these people to try and start up, because you have the Samurai TVs looking to fill all these time slots.
Even though, as of course, we know that in Japan, you know, most people don't get pay TV and blah, 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 but it must have felt gigantic at the time.
Yeah,
all of a sudden have this outlet, and... when did they start? December?
I thought November.
Wait, was November. I remember November. They launched with a big live show, right?
The live show with that Michinoku Pro match was like, I think it's like December 1st, 96 or something like that.
Okay, maybe December 1st. Yeah. But I remember November shows being on there, so it would have been taped in November, I guess.
Yeah, because I was trying to remember if I was confusing it with the Ricky Dozan Memorial or not, because I remember they had like a big Ricky Dozan Memorial show that, like a couple... Like, you know what I mean? That there were two different big multi-promotion shows, like, within a couple of weeks of each other. So,
yeah.
But, yeah, and also, yeah. Tokyo Pro was an interesting promotion.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in just a second, because we're going to hit up another little new indie that started up. Although, you know,
Not exactly an indie.
Yeah, they didn't run a whole lot of shows, but Muga, Tetsumi Fujinami's little vanity promotion, ran its debut show on October 5th in Omiya and another show on October 7th. The Omiya show drew 1390. That's a pretty good little number. And the talent of the shows were Nobuyuki Kurashima and Kazuhiko Shoda, which were Fujinami's main trainees, of course, along with Osamu Nishimura. And they also had British wrestlers such as Darren Fleck, Jessup Gira, Shane Lisby, Darren Moronis, and Johnny Patrick.
I have no idea who any of these people are.
Now, Muga was always a cool little concept. And, of course, Nishimura, like anytime he would do that whole the head scissors, handstand deal, yeah. I mean, that's straight Muga. I mean, I always liked the Muga stuff, Bix. And I love whenever they would mix it in. Like, they used it like 2002. They would use some Muga stuff. It was a cool little deal.
Well, and we should also mention who was in the main event on the first show. Joe Malenko.
Joe Malenko.
Our Veridoc message board favorite, old Death Valley Driver message board favorite.
Yeah, Joe Malenko hadn't worked in a few years in Japan, so yeah.
No, he hadn't since he was last in Fujiwara Gumi, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and this might even, because I'm trying to think, did he show up in Battle Arts after this?
Yes.
So that was his last match in Japan, I guess, but this is one of the last. But yeah, I love Muga, and I love Nishimura doing all that stuff, because once he really invented himself in New Japan, I mean, that's Muga. That's what Muga was about, sort of this 70s style merged with sort of British influence type of wrestling. And, you know, Nishimura, he doesn't really get talked about much anymore since he retired, and it's weird.
He was so good at one point. Like in 2002 to 2004, Nishimura was awesome.
He was like one of the best guys in the world.
The one match that comes to mind was the match. It was him and Nakanishi against, I think, Chono and Tenzan for the IWGP tag titles in Osaka, which at that period, that was the hottest building they had. And that was a match where he took his boots off and worked barefoot.
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord, the crowd heat for that was insane.
And there were, I mean, not just, I was thinking of some of the singles matches, because, I mean, there was the Boss Rudin match at the Tokyo Dome.
Yeah.
That and the Takayama match in the G1 were the ones that stuck out to me.
Yeah, Nishimura was really awesome in that time period. And yeah, you're right, he does not get nearly enough love. And I tell you what, a guy like him right now would be awesome in New Japan to mix up the scene there, to break up, you know, some of that monotony they got going on right now in their main events. So, yeah, Nishimura, great man. But Tokyo Pro was mentioned. And on September 30th, they announced that Nobuhiko Takada had agreed to work their show in Osaka on October the 8th against Abdullah the Butcher. Ooh, what a match. Now, Takada is basically having to whore himself out right now to promotions. That's my words, not Dave.
Okay.
To pay back the heavy debt that UWFI has on their books, as he is charging 3 million yen, or 27,000 US, per match, which is probably the highest per match price any wrestler in history has ever been able to get on a similar regular basis working indie dates in wrestling history. Sakata is believed to have earned 20 million yen, which is 180 grand, for his Tokyo Dome matches, which drew record houses. Now, reportedly, Tenryu's asking price, not that he actually got it, but he may have come close, according to Dave, for the Jingu Baseball Stadium show on September 11th against Takata was 90 grand U.S. to put Takata over. Now, this booking gives Takata some big heat with War, though, as they are running the same building in Osaka on October 11th and have already paid him his big fee to appear for them. So wow. Working Tokyo Pro kills that value, even though Takata isn't in the main event, as he is teaming with Masahito Kakihara and Naoki Sano, defending their War six-man tag titles against the great War tandem of Yoji Anjo, Bam Bam Bigelow, and Hiromichi Fuyuki. Now, Tokyo Pro's owner, Kotaro Ishizawa, is a big money mark and a huge fan of Takata and UWFI, so he jumped at the chance to book him, although the original plans for Abby was to work against his longtime rival, Taiji Singh, but that deal fell through. Now, Mike, UWFI had a great run, but this is the end of that promotion as we know it, because they are going broke. And yeah, Takata was, like I said, basically having to whore himself out to pay the debts off.
Exactly, yeah, and it's only what, 9 months removed from him selling out the Tokyo Dome, what, twice in a row with Muda? And then Hashimoto. Yeah, and Hashimoto, so.
Why didn't he stay in New Japan, though?
Yeah, that was New Japan, and then, of course, why didn't he stay?
Why didn't he decide to stay full-time?
I have no idea why he didn't stay full-time, actually. That's a good question.
Maybe New Japan was just so hot they didn't really need to. His asking price didn't really justify having him.
And that's a good point. I mean, they may not want to pay him a huge salary on a regular basis.
They really didn't need it.
Takata also was not very smart, allegedly. So
he probably didn't
realize he could have tried to make a different kind of play.
And I think Takata, you know, and eventually did go to All Japan. I think that was probably where he wanted to go anyway in the end. So
wait, he did?
Well, I'm talking about he worked All Japan, did he not? Did he work All Japan show?
I don't think so.
I could have sworn he did. I could be wrong.
I know he worked anywhere after the Tokyo Pro shows until.
I know that there was talks of him working All Japan.
Well, yeah, because I mean there was the whole thing because Takayama went there and Anjo eventually went there, but I don't think Takata worked there, right?
Right? I think there was a lot of talks of it, but it never happened.
Right, yeah.
I kind of remember that from the observers.
But I remember reading about like negotiations and stuff because there was Takayama thing and
there was the Kawada stuff.
Yeah,
they negotiated, but it never happened.
Yeah.
Okay, yes, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's face it, Baba wasn't going to pay his price.
No, he wasn't. But Takayama and All Japan would have been interesting. You know, we talked about that main event scene. So, yeah, I mean, that could definitely mix it up. Imagine Takata against Kawada.
Yeah.
Oof. What a match that would have been. But Bix, Tokyo Pro, we're about to talk about some more in a minute. That was quite the mixed bag of guys working shows.
Because it was kind of a deathmatch promotion, but kind of not. And Sabu was one of the top guys. Not for long, but I mean, I'm looking at. But we're going to talk about this.
What was Two Cold Scorpio's name there?
Black Wasama.
Yeah, there you go.
What happened with him in New Japan anyway? Why did he end up leaving?
I think it was over he wouldn't go WCW.
That's right.
Yeah.
But you know, you had guys like Shocker was working there. Billy Black was working there. My good friend. I think. God, it was just all. Didn't Bradshaw work there?
Maybe. No, not through WWF, though he was in WWF now, though.
He was already in WWF by this point.
Yeah, I'm talking about in your early days.
When did Tokyo Pro start?
I thought they may have started like in 94.
He worked War.
I may be getting Tokyo Pro confused with Now.
I think, No, he did work Now. Yeah.
Yeah, he worked Now. But yeah, I mean, there were all kinds of different guys working in and out of Tokyo Pro that was just. You know, weird. But yeah, Sabu was mentioned. And it appears that Sabu's tenure with Tokyo Pro Wrestling, which paid $6,000 US a week, ended a few days early. as Sabu flew to Osaka for his final three-match tour with the group, which was scheduled to end on October the 8th. However, when he arrived in the Osaka area, he was asked by Booker, the Booker Great Kabuki, that's right, Kabuki was booking, to put over Daiko Kubo Benkei, of course, one of the fat ball guys from Big Japan in the 2000.
Wasn't he also the original Arashi?
Arashi, his original Arashi. Yeah, and on a spot show, and refused, saying he would put over Tuco Scorpio, who wrestles here as Black Wasma, but nobody else. There are also reports that TPW attempted to pay Sabu less than his agreed amount for this tour, since it was his final tour. Sabu had been unhappy about the TPW office almost from the beginning, because he said he didn't want to work any barbed wire matches, nor work at all with Abdullah the Butcher. But, really, barbed wire matches, Sabu, he worked them in ECW. Or work at all with Abdullah the Butcher, because he recognized the style clash were made for an impossible match. He believed they went back on their word by then almost immediately booking a singles match between him and the Butcher. And with Butcher running things, it was a total Butcher match. It was believed Sabu was going to simply fly home without doing the Osaka show, but instead he did a double swerve. Sabu took a taxi to the gym, which traditionally all the wrestlers come from the hotel arena, come from the hotel to the arena to get on a bus, and came in the front door in costume just as Kabuki was announcing that Sabu had suffered an illness and wouldn't be appearing. Since Sabu was in costume running around fine in front of the fans, it basically forced TPW's hand, and they had to put Sabu on the card and had to pay him, since the fans saw him and he worked with and put over Scorpio. While this was going on, though, Sabu was involved with secret negotiations with All Japan and agreed to the deal, which would basically end up with Sabu and Rob Van Dam as a regular tag team, getting the spot vacated by Dan Crawford and Doug Furness as a mid-card team that would bounce around the All-Asian tag titles with the mid-card Japanese wrestlers. The tag team tournament starts on November 16th at Corken Hall, but Sabu got special permission to arrive 2 days later on his first tour, since he had a prior commitment to do the ECW November to Remember show on November 16th. They agreed to headlines, since one of the working plans for that show was a main event where Sabu and Terry Funk would form a team against Van Dam and a dream partner. Whether Van Dam will be available isn't known, since Van Dam will be due to start on November 16th with All Japan and thus be unavailable to ECW unless Baba gave him permission to miss the first two shows. And the Funk deal may be more of an idea than something that had actually been agreed upon. While the deal was agreed on, the contract hadn't been signed at press time. There are those within All Japan who are skeptical, since Sabu would have to totally modify his style to fit into All Japan. Now, Biggs, there's a lot of stuff going on here.
God bless Sabu.
Yeah, God bless Sabu for just totally killing that little press deal. But, yeah, just think, though. What if All Japan, what if Baba would have said, hey, you have to come on time for the tour? And that kills his appearance in November to Remember, which was the big deal.
Right, with Taz.
Because that was the lights out and him in the ring with Taz for the first time, setting up Barely Legal. So what if Baba pulls a power play there? How different does that make Barely Legal?
I mean, they could still shoot the angle. It's just not at November to Remember, and it doesn't have the symmetry with Sabu returning a year earlier and all that. But, well, also, does Paul pull anything with advertising Sabu or whatever after what happened a year earlier with a similar situation?
Yeah, that's a weird little side deal that goes on there. And Sabu and Van Dam were getting really hot as a tag team at this time in ECW and going over to All Japan. And Mike, they got really good together as a team.
Yeah, yeah, and ECW at that point for those that time run from the second half of 96 to early 97 is really based around Sabu and Van Dam as a tag team, wrestling on the Eliminators. They start out with the match at the November to Remember doing the 30-minute draw. Then they started doing the ladder matches all over the loop for early 97. And yeah, that was probably ECW's hottest act. I mean, if you take that out of November to Remember, you basically lose the Sabu Van Dam Eliminators 30-minute draw, the three-way tag later in the night, you lose the Sabu Taz stare down. That would really change things a lot.
Now, and of course, that was before Van Dam would start relying totally on gimmick and stuff like that. Rob Van Dam in 1996 is probably the best he ever was in his career.
Well, yeah, he has the match He has the match with, was it Doug Furness?
At the arena, yeah.
At the arena, yeah. That's probably one of his best matches. And then he has the, I think he has a junior title match with Kikuchi around this time.
Yeah, he had a great match with Scorpio.
Yeah.
In 96. He has some really good house show matches that we saw on FanCam.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the exact opponents, but I remember, I think he had one with Jericho that was really strong on a fan cam. But yeah, this was like, this is not RVD pointing to himself, you know, doing all that shit. This is, you know.
Yeah, that kind of comes, man. That kind of comes right after Barely Legal. But yeah, he's pretty much a different worker at this point.
Yeah, he's not yet. What is it that Dylan likes to say? RVD is Carrot Top.
Yeah, he's doing his Carrot Top shtick. Now, Tokyo Pro didn't last way too long after this pick. So, I want to say they shut the doors in 98.
It was not. I thought it was less than that. I didn't think they even lasted that long.
Let me see here. Because I think there was like two. I think there was another Tokyo Pro that popped up later on.
And there was also the original Tokyo Pro, too. Before this, decades earlier. I don't know. I really don't remember. I remember if they were still around, they were not, you know, they were not like the kind of RF video update darling that they were when they first started here.
And see, and the deal was it basically fell apart because Koto Ishizawa's, you know, business fell apart. He ran a big bike messenger business in Japan. And once that kind of went away, then, yeah. And then they reformed again as Shin Tokyo Pro Wrestling. And, Shigeo Kimura was one of their top trainees in that new incarnation. So, of course, he's working in Mexico right now, but it has been for years. But, yeah, I mean, it just one of those cases where it has so many little indie groups popping up. And it's starting to get overloaded. And, of course, we mentioned UWFI earlier. They did run a show on September 30th in Iwate before 2650 with Takada and Kazushi Sakuraba losing to Yoji Anjo and Kenichi Yamamoto in the main event. Now, Satoru Sayama worked the show, beating Naru Hoshikawa from Shinoku Pro, while ECW's Little Guido worked as James Stone, losing to Nikolai Gordo.
Now, is that a relative of Gerard Gordo?
I guess so, but yeah, Guido, when he first came to ECW, worked as James Stone, you know, and then took on
Damian Stone
and stuff like that, and became Little Guido, but yeah, UWFI, wow. This is the end of an era here.
All of the UWF promotions ended kind of ignominiously.
And, you know, we talk about Takada. Imagine if Kazushi Sakuraba hooks up in one of these wrestling promotions in New Japan or All Japan.
How different. Wow.
That changes everything.
Yeah.
So, well, Kingdom was pro wrestling, though. He does go to Kingdom.
Yeah, it was, but
Kingdom, the Kingdom is still kind of affiliated with Takada Dojo, so.
Right. And Sakuraba was fiercely loyal to Takada.
Yeah.
So anywhere Takada goes, Sakuraba probably goes with it. So like Takada did with Maeda. So yeah, man, just think about the what ifs on that one. Crazy. Yeah.
And Sakuraba, I mean, I don't think people realize just how good a worker he was because he really wasn't pushed till the very end.
Oh, he's really good. Damn good.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think almost, like, more than his UWFI stuff, the match with Otani from Skydiving Day in New Japan actually is the one that really shows just how good he was.
Yeah, definitely.
He just would have been an awesome addition to New Japan's roster at that time period. Imagine him working a few with Kanemoto and shit like that.
Yeah.
Oh, man. It's great stuff. And we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll delve into Mexico and talk about some big issues going on with AAA. And this is the beginning of the end for a tenure there. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope. Laser Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaysToBeNation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, The Place to Be Podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport, featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Sound, hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlaysToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Do you watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO PTBN Podcast Network. That's the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Zellner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows. Not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds, Wrestling Culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
You can get the full archive of Good Will Wrestling with Good Ol' Will from Texas.
There's Tag Teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWO-PTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
All right, we're back, and we're here discussing the week that was September 28th or 29th through October 5th, 1996. And we are now in AAA, and we're in Mexico, and AAA is going through a very interesting time period because the cracks are starting to show up backstage as there are major behind-the-scenes issues as the heat between Conan and Antonio Peña has built up a variety of disagreements regarding the pay of the AAA wrestlers while working in WCW, their unavailability for dates in Mexico City, and fighting over availability of the talent to work Conan's border shows. It was all expected to come to a head this week and could conceivably wind up with Conan and the wrestlers who work for WCW switching over to Promel, which is going to be renamed Promo Azteca, and Cien Caras has already jumped to Promo Azteca to join his brothers as the Dinamitas, and that promotion is making a big play to get Io Dos Santos as a regular because he's been going back and forth working house shows for them while doing TV for EMLL. And the original Mascara Sagrada, who has been working for EMLL, along with Io de Lismarck. Also, Dave said, do not be shocked to see either Mr. Niebla, Miguel Perez Jr., or Felina wind up with the group Conan ends up with, and they will be leaving EMLL. Now, Blue Panther and Fuerza Guerrera, along with Lasser and Pantherita del Ring, are expected to jump back from Promo Azteca to AAA, with Panther and Fuerza tentatively scheduled to debut on October 14th. Panther and Fuerza were the ones who basically started the Promel promotion after leaving AAA. Mexico has all of these strange bedfellows and jumps back, and it's a crazy town. But this is a huge blow to AAA coming up, because once Conan and his crew leaves Bix, I mean, that promotion, it changes forever.
Yeah, I mean, that was the beginning, really, I guess, because of, at a necessity of Pena just having to try different things that led to the modern AAA style. And it got ugly, too. I mean, I don't know if we'll end up covering it on a future show or not, but, I mean, they end up having this press conference when Conan and his guys leave for Promo Azteca, like, it was something like with him accusing Pena of hitting on Mascarita Sagrada or something like that.
Yeah, it was very personal.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, all ended up well in the end. You know, Conan went back to AAA, but that was quite the interesting period of time. And as much as people were like into the idea of Promo Azteca, I think it was more of people who didn't watch Lucha, like they saw the WCW wrestlers as the guys in the shirts and figured they must be having these great matches, and really, I mean, Promo Azteca was not actually that good.
I mean, it had its moments.
But it wasn't as good as you'd expect it to be.
I mean, Ultimo Guerrero really started making his name there. I mean, they were making guys.
But
I mean,
relative to the expectations people had for it, it was not as good. It was not this amazing dream match work rate promotion.
And the thing was, like, there were indie shows in working places like Monterey and, of course, Nuevo Laredo and stuff like that. And, of course, Tijuana, where these guys were looking way better.
Well, that's what I was going to say. The indie shows using Promo Azteca guys were generally better than the Promo Azteca shows.
Exactly. Now, Mike, the Mexican guys in WCW, they were kind of just getting shafted all the way around. You know, They weren't getting treated that great in WCW, and WCW wouldn't let them, get a whole lot of dates in Mexico, and they were having to sneak over and work. Do you think that those guys made a mistake in going to WCW, or did they make the right move? I mean, it may have helped their careers a little bit, working a different style and working. That type of ring instead of working some of those hard lucha rings. But what's your opinion?
I guess I don't. I know Bix has that list of how much everyone got paid. I mean, do you guys remember? Like, I guess it depends how much they were really making compared to what they were making in Mexico. I mean, if it was worth it. I don't know. Were they getting really big contracts? Like, what was a guy like Psicosis making? Like, he was one of the right up there at the top with right under Ray.
I think he ended up making decent, better money than most of the other guys. But I think most of them were making like $75,000, right?
That sounds about right. I mean, the downside of it...
And the Mexican economy at this time period was starting to dip.
Right. I mean, so the only downside... You can definitely say for sure is that once WCW was out of business, I mean, these guys were never the same. Like, they took all the... They killed the confidence of, like, you know, a Psicosis and a Juventud. They were these incredible workers, and they were, you know, they still were good after WCW, but they were never what they were, like... I don't know if they grew to hate wrestling or whatever from being WCW.
Yeah, and...
It did make for that fun year of 2001, though, when they all came back
and worked TMLL.
MLL and Tijuana. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Really invigorated the scene.
Yeah.
Especially Ray. Ray in latter WCW was, like, sterilized in a lot of ways. And then he comes back to Mexico and, like, it looks like old Ray again.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, it was just... I think they probably made the best move they could make financially, and that's what all matters.
Yeah.
Especially you have families, so.
Yeah, and CMLL in general was just so good in 2001. Yeah.
And let's not forget with the Luchadors, too, how many times they were probably brought to shows and not even used. They probably just showed up and sat backstage doing nothing. I mean, that's a pretty good gig if you can get it.
Yeah. All right, so I have Psicosis is paying in front of me, at least. And this is what they ended up getting paid in the calendar year. It does not reflect the contract.
Right.
So, 96... So in 96, he got $7,278, which that's, considering he was pretty much full-time starting around July, that sounds pretty low.
Yeah, it doesn't sound right.
Yikes.
43,282 and change.
If that 7,000 number is legit, he was probably getting something like, what, $100 a shot or something?
Yeah, I'm guessing he wasn't on a contract yet.
Yeah.
So 98, he makes 107,000 and change. 98, he also makes 16,000 and change licensing that year. 99, he makes just under $150,000 plus 37,000 license. Okay, so he made close to $200,000 that year. And then in 2000, when did he leave in 2000?
Early in 2000,
he took home 70,000 in 2000.
He was already with ECW by like July, I want to say. He had that match with Tajiri, July, August.
Yeah.
Okay, so he was probably on, what, $150,000 guarantee at least?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
that's okay. That's pretty good, considering.
He's working elsewhere, too, so he's got more money coming in than just that. So.
He had mass payoffs, though he lost his mask twice.
Yeah.
He got a payoff in Tijuana for losing his mask there.
Now, this is in real name order. Give me someone else to look up for comparison, because he was probably on the top end.
Super Colo, maybe?
Well, look at Ray.
I'm saying I need a real name, so I'll get up out for it. For it to be quicker, though. So, Ray. Well, Ray, I can do.
What about,
here we go, Vianos. I found the Vianos, because
Ray Mendoza, yeah.
I mean, it shows a lot of the gimmick names, too. Okay, so...
Raimundo Mendoza, yeah.
Okay, Viano Cuarta makes a little under $2,400 in 96. I'll call them 4 and 5, just because it's easier for me to say right now than Cuarta and Quinta. So 4 makes 45,000 in 97, 45 and change. His brother makes 14,000 and change. In 98, it's closer, 64,000 and change and 50,000 and change. No licensing for either of these guys, and I guess that's it. Yeah, so the rank and file luchadors were not making that much, no.
Yeah, that's Yeah, still, they're probably making way better than where they were making in Mexico. So
yeah, but I mean, it goes to what everyone talks about, though. They were being exploited as guys that were being paid really much less than they should have been.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, they are guys who maybe could, more than anyone, could have joined in on the, racial discrimination shoot, and none did. It was mostly, with Sonny Ono and various, various black guys, including Power Plant guys, and also a Power Plant guy from Laos who sued for discrimination. So, interesting group of guys. But you look at that stuff, and everyone had a good case because of how bad things were. But where were we?
Yeah. Now back to AAA. They are continuing the Super Muñeco turn, although not necessarily to babyface.
I don't remember him being a heel.
Muñeco teamed with Los Villanos on an October 4th show in Oximilco against Ultimo Dragon, Tenebris Jr., La Parca, and Octagon, and basically laid down in a third fall and allowed Parca to pin him after he and the Villanos had problems. Villanos then destroyed him after the match, leaving him what was described as a swimming pool of blood, until finally Los Payasos, Tricolor, made the save, which that's Coco Blanco, Coco Rojo, the other clowns. It appears they're going to wind up with a heel versus heel feud over the Mexican National Atomicos titles with Perov Jr. and the Villanos versus the Payasos and Muñeco. So, yeah, the clowns were heels, which AAA love using clowns as heels.
And here you have two different, like, you have Los Payasos and you also have Super Muñeco, who are unifying in, like, clown, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, they're...
clown unity,
solidarity.
Baby.
Solidarity, yeah, clown solidarity.
Yeah, solidarity, yeah. Yeah, I don't remember this. So yeah, I mean that's crazy. But Super Muñeco was a guy who was really good, in his day, and he had the kids promotion in Monterey, which was Lucha for Children, which that's where the Thundercats first started, right, Bix?
I thought that feud was in the regular Monterey promotion.
Well, I know, but I think it started in the kids' promotion. But,
what was it called? AIWA, AIWF,
yeah,
something like that?
Yeah.
That was a hell of, I love that match so much, that mask match. I mean, you know that, but is that on YouTube still?
I think so.
Look up, for anyone who's never seen it, look up Thundercats, is it labeled Thundercats versus Trio Fantasia?
I think so.
So look up Thundercats versus Trio Fantasio on YouTube. It is one of the great, one of the most awesome, weird, great matches you'll ever see, because it's, let's see, because it's Super Muñeco, Super Raton, who's Mighty Mouse, basically, and who was the third
Super
one?
Super Pinocchio.
Yeah, Super Pinocchio. So Pinocchio against the Thundercats. And the Thundercats being heels as the Thundercats. So,
yeah.
And there's mask ripping, and it's bloody, and it's horrifying, but with kids' gimmicks, and just wonderful.
It's fantastic. It's Lucha Libre.
Yeah, I saw that for the first time on one of the yearbooks. The yearbooks. That thing is incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And now we are back in the United States, and we are going to a promotion that aired locally in Atlanta on Channel 69, the channel that Joe Pedicino last has his block on. And I remember seeing this promotion and thinking, what in the hell is this? And that is the AWF, which was Paul Alperstein's promotion. And basically, it was a hodgepodge of older guys, mainly a lot of guys that were had AWA histories, although they had WWF guys in there as well. Their lead announcer was Mick Karch, and their color guy was a crippled Lord Alfred Hayes, who was doing his full-on heel gimmick from the early 80s and was really good at it, although he sucked at announcing. And
they also had Killer Ken Resnick doing interviews and Missy Hyatt as a different, not doing the Missy Hyatt character.
Yeah, exactly. What was she doing? I can't remember.
She was like roving reporter Missy Hyatt.
Yeah, roving reporter Missy Hyatt. And you had like Sheik Adnan Casey as the heel manager. They had matches that had rounds. They were doing a round system. The big feud was Tito Santana against Bob Orton Jr. in 1996. Their lead heel tag team, which we'll talk about in a minute, is Tommy Rich and Greg the Hammer Valentine. Or Luscious Tommy Rich, not Wildfire. Luscious Tommy Rich and Greg the Hammer Valentine, managed by Rico Suave. And, oh, man, and Coco Beware was there. Nails was there. I mean, it was wild. But the Road Warriors had made their debut on the October 5th television show in an interview with Ken Resnick, saying they had come here to meet fresh faces, such as the lead heel team of Tommy Rich and Greg Valentine. Now, Mike, did you ever see this AWF stuff?
Yeah, Bix, we used to get it, at midnight on Channel 2 on Saturday nights?
Okay, so what happened was we first got it in 95. The pilot aired on MSG, like, right after ECW.
Yeah.
And that was, and it had different, it had some of the same guys and different guys. I think it had
and
Scorpio.
We had it on midnight. Yeah.
Yeah, and it had Scorpio. I remember Scorpio against Bobby Bradley, I think. And I think they also did the Tito Orton match for the title twice, for the vacant title, like they did
and
on the pilot.
Freebirds worked
in 96. I don't remember that.
Yeah, Freebirds worked in 95. Yeah, Freebirds
okay,
worked
on
95.
The pilot stuff. Yeah, yeah, and then in 90, so then in 96, when they did their big national syndication push, we got it for like 3 weeks, I think.
Channel 2 CBS, we got it at midnight on Saturday nights.
And we also got it 3 weeks behind everyone else, because we started 3 weeks behind
and
everyone else.
And I had it midnight. I had it midnight on Saturday night. And I think we got like 2 or 3 months of it. Because yeah. I actually still have some of that stuff on VHS.
So it lives on in infamy. There was about a 4-disc DVD set released of it.
Oh, I forgot about that. That's right.
The Warriors of Wrestling.
One of my local libraries has that, I think.
Warriors of Wrestling. But yeah, it was taped in an Indian casino, I think, in Minnesota.
Well, it had really good production values. That was the big thing with them. Was that as weird as it was with all the old wrestling stuff, it looked great.
Yeah, and it just had a bunch of guys that were past their prime and being pushed. Jim Brunzell was the commissioner. Tom Zink was there. I mean, they just had a lot of names from the late 80s. So yeah, it's just a weird time.
But yes, if you want to get the DVD set, you can find it, I'm sure, various places online for cheap.
Yeah,
you can find it from Amazon sellers. I'm looking, starting from $6.
What happened to Paul Alperstein?
He spent too much money.
Well, that's a common mistake for indie promoters.
Oh, I just remembered something. Since we were already talking about Dominic Valenti earlier, I remember that when he was talking about this and the rumors about the AWF was that they may get that there was rumors about them getting an investment from, and I quote,
some guy named Rupert Murdoch.
That's classic.
Great, Dominic. Well, we'll move on from one indie that's, you know, trying to go national and failing to one that's on the verge of going national and getting a huge buzz, and that's ECW.
I thought you were going to say we're going to go from one indie that's trying to go national and failing to another that is trying to go national and will eventually fail.
Well, they had a little bit more longer shelf life. But we're in ECW, and the Sandman has regained the ECW heavyweight title in what apparently was a last-minute decision in an Ultimate Jeopardy tag match to headline the October 5th show at ECW Arena. The scheduled match was Sandman and Tommy Dreamer versus Raven and Brian Lee, where the stipulations were, if Sandman lost, he took 10 lashes from the Singapore Cane. Bueller would have to leave ECW if Tommy Dreamer lost. Raven would lose his title to whoever pinned him. And Brian Lee would have to get his head shaved. The match had to be changed at the last minute due to personal problems involving Raven, which are expected to keep him out of action for an undetermined length of time, believed to be around a few weeks, which pretty much came to a head the previous day. Now, with a combination of both the champion missing the show and the challengers in the ECW tag title match, who were the Rock and Roll Express, also no showing for reasons on clear press time, although they worked a show that same night in Harrogate, Tennessee. Instead, Booker Paul Heyman figured he had to give the sellout crowd an estimated 1,200, something extra to make up for, and gave them a previously unplanned title change. Stevie Richards subbed for Raven, and with Raven's stipulations about the title change reverting to Richards, Sandman pinned Richards after a DDT to capture a title. The nutty Tommy Dreamer bump of the show came when Lee chokeslammed him off the stage through four tables, a bump that looked visually more impressive than the previous three table bump because the tables all broke.
And now, that one was in the opening of the show for the next whatever, so they went out of business.
Oh, yeah, exactly. It's one of the most memorable spots in promotion. Now, to explain from a storyline perspective what the temporary absence of Raven, they did a post-show angle in a hotel room that will air on television next week, where they have a press conference for Sandman win the title. And at the event, Richards comes out and they explain that Sandman files custody papers to get custody of his son, Tyler. And that when Raven found out, he skipped the country with Sandman's son and both are nowhere to be found. Mike, this was the Sandman-Raven angle was, I mean, it was really like cutting edge for its time period. And I know a lot of people really didn't like it. They thought it was too over the top. What were your thoughts about it?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the darkest angles I think you could really in ECW ever did. The one that I always remember is when Sandman's about to cane, what is it, Raven, and his son stands, Tyler steps right in front of Raven, is, "Daddy, you're drunk." Like, that's, you know, he's only, how old was Tyler at that time? I mean, he couldn't have been older than maybe six or seven years old.
Six or seven, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was real dark stuff. And like, they would do those promos, like when the Pulp Fiction montages, where Raven is just sitting there with, like, you know, holding Tyler in his arms with Laurie standing there. I mean, it was really, really dark stuff. Yeah, I mean, I guess the biggest, the only sad part about it was there kind of really never was a big payoff to it. It was just like kind of like Tyler and Laurie disappeared after a while. And I think, you know, later on,
yeah, then they did the deal where Tyler hugged his dad and turned on him. And
yeah. And I think Laurie basically just disappeared. Like, he never really had a
Sandman.
Right, right.
What was that, bitch?
That he came out dressed as Sandman when they did that.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, they totally blew it.
Well,
yeah.
Raven's talked about
I really
this,
think they
right?
did.
As in, well, this is kind of when it fell apart. And Raven, isn't this when Raven has talked about that this is when he went to rehab?
Yes.
I mean, and he's been open about that. So, I mean, that's kind of what happened. And I think I even remember him, I think he talked about it on Observer Radio, and I remember him putting over Dave for not writing anything about it, too. But that's just kind of what happened. I mean, look, I mean, you got to do what you got to do, so.
And he came back, and he came back, like, mysteriously 30 days later. And, you know, it restarted the angle, but it lost its juice in a lot of ways because of him leaving. But yeah, the whole deal with the Laurie Fullington, you know, her role in it, because you remember she was Peaches from early ECW and looking totally different than what she would become in this feud. I mean, this was all Scott Levy. This was Scott Levy's baby right here. You know, you could tell everything was all had his touch on it.
This is the
probably the best overall work he ever did as Raven too. I would
say. Oh, totally. And
booking, I know, matches, promos, everything.
I got friends that you know say that they prefer the Raven Sandman feud over the Raven Dreamer feud.
Oh, absolutely. I don't even think they're. I think the Dreamer feud has the legacy for obvious reasons, but in terms of everything else, I think this was a much better program.
Yeah, definitely.
I loved this when it was happening. Dreamer Raven was like, you could tell they wanted it to be big. This was organically a big deal. And yeah, and I love all this stuff with Tyler, the whole, daddy, you're drunk now, I was it waving. Dad, and the one you were talking about where it's in the Pulp Fiction and Raven sitting with him and Laurie and just like, hey, Tyler, you know your dad doesn't love you anymore, right? And then Tyler just goes, I know, and closes his eyes and does the Raven cross pose. Yeah. It's so creepy, and I love this. Although it did screw with them with getting pay-per-view. Because they, like,
yeah, it did.
Like, the whole request thing, I mean, they did end up picking them up for Barely Legal, but the delays, like, a lot of that had to do with this. I mean, maybe you could argue even more so than the Eric Koolis thing.
Yeah, remember the TV show with they had like the camcorder footage of like Tyler's birthday at like Lori's house or whatever, and then yes. It's like Stevie and Meanie are there.
Oh God, yeah, being the clowns and whatever. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, ECW television was so good this time. This is their year. This is the greatest year in the promotion, in my opinion.
This is the year that everything came together. I mean, we talked about this before. There are individual parts that might be better, and I like a lot of the late '94 and '95 stuff, and I think I even prefer that because that's when I really got into it. But overall, I mean, this is the ECW that everyone talked about. Even if there were people who came on later and they, you know, so they identified more with Van Damme and all that, this is it. This is the ECW that should have been on pay-per-view. And just, unfortunately, it kind of peaked at Barely Legal and then just kind of went downhill from there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's talk about the Rock and Roll Express. Now, with Rock and Roll Express, who were never actually announced on television, as the TV publicity listed as gangsters defending their titles against a mystery team, missing the show, Heyman wound up with two tag title matches on the show. First, the gangsters went to a no contest with Richards and Meanie, who were dressed up like Public Enemy and called Flyboy Stevie and Meanie Grunge, which I remember watching this on television. And when that music hit, the ECW arena exploded, thinking that Public Enemy had come home. And boy, were they in for a surprise there. When the Eliminators interfered, and then the Eliminators got an unadvertised title shot later in the show and lost. But after the match, Perry Saturn put a table on the top rope and a ladder on the top of the table came off the top of the ladder twice, doing a fist drop on each gangster. And then we had, we'll talk about this in a second. Let me go back to Rock and Roll Express. The situation Rock and Roll Express appears to be that they didn't get their plane tickets until the last minute, and by that point had already agreed to do the Tennessee show. They still may be brought in to work with the gangsters, as Paul Heyman wants the gangsters as tag champs to work longer than the length of their song and longer than a brawl with weapons and a garbage can lasts, and those of Rock and Rolls are good enough workers to pull that off. And of course, that never happened. Ricky Morton eventually came in solo in early '97, but yeah, we never got the Rock and Roll Express in ECW. And Bix, I thought that would have been a pretty cool deal, though. But because we know how great the gangsters Rock and Rolls feud were in Smoky Mountain. Now you have it in reverse, where the gangsters are the faces and Rock and Rolls are the heels.
That would have been great. I mean, that's really, really a smart move on Heyman's part. And I feel really bad that it didn't happen, because I think that would have just helped a lot with the depth of the cards, that you had the Rock and Roll able to carry the gangsters to real matches. Because, you know, the main event was kind of thin. I mean, but when you have, if you give the gangsters more to work with, and then you have the singles guys doing their own thing, and all that, I think it works out better than things did. And I think they could have gotten some decent legs out of it. And then, you know, think about what else you have. You have the Eliminators turn babyface. You can have them working with the Rock and Rolls. The Rock and Rolls can kind of give some structure.
Sabu and RVD.
Yeah, I think that would have worked out great. I mean, especially the way the ECW audience would react.
Bubba and Spike against the Rock and Roll Express.
Yeah, but and the way that Heyman knew how to play them, and like, this is the type, I like, I would love to see what he could have done with the Rock and Rolls as heels.
What sucks is that they actually did eventually, well, they almost did this, what, 3 months later, they did Gangsters vs. Ricky Morton and Tommy Rich, but it was just it was a quick squash, and it was it. It never went anywhere with it.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it would definitely have been interesting. Now, one of the more memorable things that came from this show was we had Shane Douglas go to a no decision with Pitbull 2. Douglas attacked Pitbull 1, who was still wearing his halo, which Dave said he believed he actually hasn't needed it for about a week, in an angle that turned the place silent. As they were attending to Pitbull 1, Joel Gertner, the heel ring announcer, announced Douglas as the winner and was tackled first by Todd Gordon and later by Heyman. Pitbull 1 was taken away in an ambulance. This was a hot, hot angle.
The highest angle in ECW history.
And this was the one that, yeah, Gertner really found himself in this angle as well.
Oh, he is so good here.
This is when he starts wearing his the suit jacket without the shirt and the tuxedo. And he's not fat yet. He's getting there. But, oh, man, you talk about heat. Oh, my Lord, this had so much heat.
This is one of those ones you could watch back on the network, too, and it's not ruined by the fact that there's, like, music. There's no music to edit out or anything. Because when they showed this on TV, I mean, it's one of the most incredible, like, 10 minutes of TV that ECW ever did. Because Joey Styles leaves the broadcast booth, so it's like there's no commentary. And it's just all these baby faces hitting the ring going after Douglas. And he's running out through they have, like, the fan cam footage of him running out of the building. And, like, all the heels are, like, congratulating him and laughing. And, like, meanwhile, there's, like, 20 guys in the ring attending to Pitbull.
Dreamer's running after him, trying to attack him.
Yeah, yeah. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, this is ECW at their best as far as, like, doing angles and character development. And this, you know, Shane Douglas really became the guy, the lead heel in the promotion in this angle.
Yeah.
And he was a great – I mean, he may not have been the best in the ring, but in this character, this was Shane Douglas. I mean, he was – awesome in this role.
He's an underrated worker, though. I think this is the.
Yeah.
It's more that this was just around when he started to break down physically.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. His in ring couldn't match up with his out of the ring character. His fault.
Yeah, and he still had really good matches earlier in the year. Like he had those great matches with Mikey. So it wasn't
the match with Scorpio that year.
Oh, yeah,
probably his best match.
Yeah. So
yeah.
Not like he didn't have the talent.
Yeah, 96. Yeah, 96 was good. Now when he starts getting the arm injury and stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah.
He starts putting on a lot of weight as he keeps getting the injuries and stuff, and then he was just, it was downhill for him after that.
Oh, yeah. He added, like, 20 pounds at least, I think.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That really affected him.
Yeah. And I think the two keys to this angle are, A, I think, the thing with Douglas shaking the halo, I think what makes it work so well is you just couldn't conceive of the idea that he wore the halo past not needing it in real life. It just feels real because you could never just wrap your head around the idea. You wouldn't think in your head, oh my god, he doesn't really need the halo anymore. Because that almost seems like something, you know what I mean? It feels like too far just for, you know, I'm using the term for effect, fake pro wrestling. You know what I mean? So the idea that he shook it, it feels real. It's not like you've ever seen anyone else in a halo brace in wrestling before either. And then, of course, Gertner, I think, really, he takes a hot angle and puts it over the top.
Yeah.
The way he keeps trying to announce Douglas as the winner.
Yeah. And that leads into a thing that David said. He said, expect Joel Gertner to get an even bigger push, which, you know, he eventually would once he got aligned with the Dudleys when Bubba turned. But yeah, he was so great in that character as the anti-Bob Ortiz. Oh man. I loved it. Now, Paul Heyman is thinking about using Lance Storm, Rod Price, and Tommy Rogers, although no deal has been made as of yet. And, of course, all of them would come in, at some point or the other.
Yeah, I mean, Lance Storm came in very shortly after this, but I think, you know, Rod Price and Tommy Rogers are quite a while away before they come in.
Yeah. Now, Lance Storm, of course, we saw him at the Garden last night. ECW made him. You know, without ECW, who knows where Lance Storm is today, right, Mike?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, he's probably working some Canadian indie scene or whatever. You know, he might have been working for ECCW or something like that. Who knows?
And you take a guy like him, too. It's like, if it wasn't for Paul, I mean, Paul's genius of getting people over. You know, I don't know that anyone else was going to get Lance. No, all due respect to Lance, I don't know how many people were going to get him over, especially, you know, WWE.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about, like, where else, where would he have been at this time? I guess he was making his money in war and wrestling places like for Tony Condello between tours, I guess?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because he was full-time for WAR in 96, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean,
he made him.
But, yeah, I don't, like, he had been in Smoky Mountain, but, like, he was just kind of off the radar as anyone you would think of as, like, really clicking in the States because of how the Smoky Mountain run went.
Yeah, and Jericho was far bigger star.
Right, and Jericho was the guy with more the charisma and the star power and all that. And Jericho was starting... I mean, he had come to WCW, he was sort of floundering so far, but yeah, so we...
Well, the one thing you have to remember with Paul, too, is that every time he lost, like, somebody, he was always looking to the next set of people to bring in. So he loses Benoit, Malenko, and Guerrero, and it's like, okay, I gotta bring in Mysterio, Psychosis, and these guys. And now he had just lost, in August, he had lost Jericho, he was about to lose Scorpio, so it's like he was always scouting for, he had his list of guys ready to come in as soon as the next guys left. Which was important, too, because he was always being raided.
Yeah, and that's something that some of these indie promoters today, Ring of Honor, need to think about doing,
yeah.
More often. You know, it's always try to replenish the talent.
Yeah, I mean, Gabe was always good at, he learned from Paul, Gabe was always great at that. You know, when he lost a bunch of guys, he had his list of the next guys ready to come in.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, and now, look at what may or may not be happening with Gabe, is the best way to put it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But, speaking of promotions that were losing a lot of talent, now we go to Memphis, Tennessee, and USWA, which is now really starting to go downhill. And the big news of the week is that Randy Hales has quit the promotion as the general manager. Now, the week before, it was announced he was going to quit as the booker. Well, now he's altogether gone. Although he hasn't entirely quit everything just yet, he's moved from Nashville back to Jonesboro, Arkansas, and will run the USWA shows in those towns, but he has done as a road manager, largely over the frustration with the company, all the problems that anyone who has ever worked for the company ends up having. Not certain who will be taking his position, but Jerry Lawler is now booking, but he's gone most of the time, and he can't run all the shows since he won't be at most of them. Now, Randy Hales was with that promotion as a teenager. You know, he was a lifer, and he left. Of course, he eventually came back. But that's a big deal to lose a guy like him. I mean, he's one of those guys that, one of those key behind the scenes guys, Bix, you need to be around. And without him there, I mean, that promotion was really starting to spiral down.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds funny. I'm sure that some people listening when they hear Chris say general manager, but that's what he did. He was kind of the promoter, but not the promoter. You know what I mean? Like him and, trying to think who else had the general manager title in wrestling. I guess Larry Madison in St. Louis after Mushnick retired, right?
Yeah.
So guys who kind of took over the duties of what the promoter would have done running the office and all that. And, I mean, he was the kind of the heart of the company by that time. And I'm trying to remember, did he come back at all or was he gone till Power Pro started?
He came back when Power Pro started, though.
Yeah, because I don't remember him being around in 97 at all.
Right. Well, he was in the NOD. Angle.
Yeah, Randy X.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Randy X.
But
yeah.
He was done as more than just a local promoter in town.
Yeah, I think he was just a character at that time period. But and he was awesome. Go back and watch that stuff. It's on YouTube. Randy X.
So I'm trying to remember Randy X, Tracy Mothers as Smothers as Shaquille Ali.
Shaquille Ali, yes.
Who else?
PG-13 was part of that.
PG-13, of course. What's his name? Spellbinder was in Nation, right?
Yeah, Spellbinder. I can't remember his gimmick.
Was he Elijah yet?
He may have been Elijah, yeah.
And I feel like I'm forgetting. I feel like there were a few other people, but yes, the USWA Nation was not at all the same as the Nation on WWF television.
It's fantastic.
And
now,
But Hales, like I'm trying to think now. Also, Jerry Jarrett is still head shoulder to shares by this point, right?
Yes, he's pretty much out completely.
So,
and it's Lawler and
Larry Burton.
Larry Burton, yeah, Larry Burton.
Yeah. So, well, that we don't have enough time to explain that part. So,
yeah. So, yeah, I mean, they're doing terrible business. And reports of the
in every respect of the term, in every sense of the term, they are doing terrible business.
Now, something that's didn't happen in this week, but happened right before it was they drew the smallest paid attendance ever in Memphis. Thursday.
A common theme this week, huh?
Yeah, the Thursday before, I think it would have been the 26th or 27th, something like that. But they drew like 300 and something people at the flea market, which they weren't even running Mid-South Coliseum much that time. They were running the flea market.
Which they tried to put over as an improvement on TV, though.
Yeah.
You won't have to go through metal detectors.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's all sorts of great food. You can get catfish at the food court. It's not the flea market. It's the Big One Expo Center. Don't call it the flea market.
Yeah. It's like called ECW Arena Bingo Hall. But the reports that Wrestling Observer received on October 3rd was that the match where Brian Christopher kept his USWA title by beating Flash Fannigan with his feet on the ropes was one of the best matches in Memphis for a while. The opposite, though, could be said about a match with local DJ John Rainey and Scott Bowden, our dear friend Scott Bowden, described as the worst match in wrestling history, complete with ring announcer Corey Macklin announcing Bowden as the winner when Rainey at one point was so blown up he couldn't get up, even though Rainey was supposed to win. They had to restart the match and do a quick roll-up that was also pretty messed up. The unified heavyweight title match in that show had Lawler defending against Stephen Dunn, with the finish being that Lawler kept using an object and finally had it hidden in his mouth. Dunn punched him in the stomach. Lawler coughed, and the object came out of the mouth, and the ref saw it for the disqualification. Now, the next night, Lawler loses his unified title to Colorado Kid, Mike Rapata, in Jonesboro, Arkansas. Kid is a top star for the North American All-Star Wrestling Group that runs in Arkansas, Missouri, and has a working relationship with USWA. Kid shows up on live Memphis television the next morning with Burt Prentice, his promoter, and as his manager, and Prentice said that Lawler was the most famous wrestler in the world and the only true world champion. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, this is not the Smoky Mountain feud from a year earlier.
No.
This is just a bad time in Memphis. And Colorado Kid, wow, Bix, former NWA World Heavyweight Champion, Colorado Kid, Mike Rapata. People don't really – I mean, that was an era in wrestling like people really don't talk about, you know, that era of Mike Rapata on the indie scene. But, yeah, the him being spotlighted was pretty interesting.
He was not a bad babyface worker. He really wasn't. Yeah. but
he didn't have that blowjob babyface look either, although that's a funny way of saying talking about Mike Rapata, but but yeah,
I think if people didn't see him as Prentice's boy, he wouldn't have gotten as bad a rap, though.
Yeah, I think, yeah. It had a lot to do with it, but...
He was good at being a Southern-style babyface. He was not a main event-level guy, but he was fine. I mean, it just... But I think the Prentice thing gives him a worse rap than he should have. I mean, it's not like he's Adam Windsor. You know what I mean? Where he couldn't really do anything, but...
Yeah.
But you know what, that's not even a territory though, but you know, is the top guy in a promotion for reasons, and you know what I mean. Anyway, yeah, Adam Windsor and Mike Rapata were like the, you know, and they both show up in magazines just seemingly for no reason too. That's the whole thing.
Yeah.
That's the type of thing people don't remember, I think, when, you know, when they were in close with promoters or whatever, or photographers as the case may be, that you'd see these indie guys just keep showing up in magazines for no reason. And you wonder why, and then eventually you find out. And or as you see people in promotions, like John Laurinaitis. And, you know, I mean, everyone gives him shit, but Johnny Ace was really good in All Japan.
Yeah. Now, Mike, this is 1996, and Memphis is still promoting, you know, even though they have WWF assistance, but, you know, all the territories have pretty much died out. They're the only one left standing. I mean, that's a true testament. A true testament to them.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they lasted that long.
Yeah, they were trying everything towards the end. Like, they were no longer running Mondays. They were trying Wednesdays. And if you, like, when you watch the 97 episodes, I mean, they're running all different nights of the week. just trying to like see what works and running different places. But they kept up a fight till the very, very end, at least. I mean, far more than Smoky Mountain did, I think, because Smoky Mountain was like once Cornette didn't think there was a anything to do anymore and any way to make money, shut it down. But I think USWA kept going for a while before it was a it was very, very obvious it was too late.
Well, the difference is Cornette didn't want Cornette had people who were willing to back the company, like Landell's friends and all that.
Yeah, he didn't want
to. Yeah, he didn't want he didn't want to keep it going. Lawler went in with Larry Burton and found the Selkers, and
yep,
that ended up in court for years and years.
Yeah. Jim didn't want it on his conscience that he was going to waste somebody else's money when he knew it wasn't possible to, you know, make any money.
Hey, but yeah. Jerry Lawler did fine in court. I mean, he the jury loved him, so he
didn't know.
Well, he's Jerry Lawler. You know, how can you not like Jerry Lawler?
That's a tape I'd love to see.
Yeah, exactly. All right, now we're moving on to WCW, the hottest wrestling promotion in the world, although what a week they've had here. Ric Flair met with Dr. James Andrews. Dun, dun, dun. Every time I hear his name, I feel like that should be playing in the background. Dun, 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 because it's always bad news. He met with Dr. James Andrews in Birmingham on September 30th, and he recommended shoulder surgery to repair his torn rotator cuff, which would put him out of action for close to a year. Flair was originally scheduled for an operation on October 3rd in Birmingham, but WCW wanted him to get a second opinion from one of their own doctors.
Oh, God.
Who also recommended surgery, which was expected to take place sometime this week. Now, Flair had shoulder problems dating back to the early part of the year, but the injury got so bad it put him on the shelf after a September 21st match in Tokyo against Kensuke Sasaki. So an angle was done on the October 7th Nitro where Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, Six, and the Giant supposedly attacked Flair with a baseball bat for the storyline to explore an explanation of his absence. The only thing that aired was in an obviously lit up portion of the dressing room with studio lights visible. Flair was on the ground writhing in pain. Elizabeth and Woman were in the background almost in tears. An aluminum baseball bat was around along with the NWO members. Before surgery was performed, it was believed that Flair would require 3 months post-surgery before he could return. Flair eventually did have the surgery on October 23rd.
Okay, now, do you remember seeing the segment and what stands out about it?
I haven't seen it in almost 20 years. Okay. It's on the network. It's on the network, so...
It's very obviously not Ric Flair.
Yeah.
There it is. I'm just going to assume that it's Paul Lee on the ground in a Ric Flair robe, face down, with an NWO standing over him. And the best part is they are playing audio sound of Flair selling from an old match. And I remember, do you remember Shadow that made those Ric Flair legend comps? I'm sure Mike does.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I remember him pointing out that the clips they chose that Flair would, well, he would swear when he was selling during matches. So on Nitro, and they're turning the sound up, so as not Ric Flair is writhing on the ground with the, you know, with his face down, you hear a Flair going, ah, fuck, ah, shit, ah, fuck, on basic cable television.
Yeah, Mike, this was, and I remember Woman Elizabeth was overacting in this.
Oh, yeah.
Hilarious. Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, beginning of a time period where Flair was not around a whole lot, you know, for various reasons. And he was the, you know, WCW. I mean, of course, Sting was always considered the franchise, but Ric Flair was WCW.
Yeah, you know what the thing was, though? This was the best thing that happened to his career during that time, because then what happened was every week he would come out and he'd do that promo with Mean Gene. And it revitalized his career in a way. He was so over, and people were dying for him to come back by the time May came. And, of course, you know, WCW blew it, of course, you know, after a couple of months. But it was like not being in the ring and just cutting a promo every week was the best thing that happened for him. I remember that one where he came out. I think it was in Carolina a couple of weeks later, and he came out with was it Shaq he came out with?
Yeah, him and he did one with Shaq, yeah, but he did one. I know Kevin Green, of course, was around.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a highlight of Nitro every week, was Mean Gene would bring him out every week and he would just cut a great promo.
Mean by God,
Gene. Yeah, that's that's when
and then stuff with Piper, you know, when Piper showed up, you know, they were doing Trump, that's right.
And they, I mean, they didn't go along with it, but they really did a tremendous job building up his return.
Yeah.
With that match at Slamboree, and, you know, good guys went over for once, and although they didn't, they could have done more with him and Six as a singles feud, though.
Definitely.
I would like, and Flair and Hall as a singles feud, I think would have been real good.
Yeah, that could have gone well, but I mean, you know, Flair and Six, of course, we think of the great Flair promo, and maybe the best Flair promo of the Nitro era, which, I mean, it depends on if you count the return in Greenville as a promo, but I've had more titles than world titles than you've had pieces of ass.
Yeah. Classic Ric Flair. Classic.
And
this is basically also the setup for Jeff Jarrett to take his spot in the Horsemen.
Oh, fuck.
That was a whole big drama. Remember, that was one of the downsides of it, was every week you'd have that interview with Mean Gene where, like, Flair would be talking and then you'd have Jarrett, McMichael, and Benoit fighting with each other over whether or not Jarrett should be in the Hall.
Yeah, bro.
Flair just kind of liked Jarrett because he would strut with him. And
that was brutal.
And Deborah starting to become a complete annoyance.
Yeah.
And Jarrett, you know, by the way, his contract with WWF expired on October 6th. So the day after we're doing, you know, recovering this week. And so he was in WCW not too long after that. But
yeah, I think he shows up that Monday.
Yeah, exactly. So
Jeff Jarrett's career during this period was very strange. The whole, like, from 95 until to the end of 97, he's just coming and going, and then just finally doesn't really settle into anything until, like, you know, when he becomes Double J again in 98.
He doesn't find himself until then, until he cuts his hair.
Right.
It changes his look. When he changed his look, that's when he got hot. But, yeah, I mean, that whole thing was terrible with Jarrett and the Horsemen. But moving on. Sting, of course, who is now out, starting up his new storyline. It's actually to explain his absence because he's filming Liar Liar, starring Jim Carrey. And Dave, with a great line, says, I could think of a lot of wrestling personalities who should be stars in the movie with that name.
I think that scene, he was only in one scene and it was cut from the movie, so.
Yeah!
That would be great if he got a year and a half off from wrestling, so he could film one scene that wasn't even in a movie.
Wasn't in the Observer later that the idea of the scene was that Jim Carrey's character, you know, now that he can't tell a lie, is trying to go along with his son and convince him that wrestling is real? But he can't.
Well, I know there's a scene in the movie where Jim Carrey suggests that he takes his son to see a wrestling match. Like, I remember that.
So that's still in there. I wonder if it's on the DVD in there. Or Blu-ray or anything, but the deleted scene.
Yeah, it might be.
Well, maybe it is, but this, you know, that was the original plan for the absence, but, it took its own life when Scott Hall, you know, talked about, you know, doing the Crow.
Yep.
And they took it from there, but yeah. You know, Sting was just going to be out just doing the movie, and that was it. So, how things change. But anyway, on the September 30th Nitro, which was live in Cleveland, it drew 4,318 paid for a $52,000 gate for what Dave says was one of the worst Nitros in history. Nitro had only been a little over a year old. The live crowd reacted furiously, pelting the ring with garbage after the show went off the air, since the matches were, for the most part, terrible. The show was built around the NWO having a party in a hotel room, so none of them were actually at the building. Plus, you add the fact that Ric Flair out with his injury, Sting starting his angle, and Randy Savage being part of the angle at the hotel, the star power inside the building was very low. The fans really got pissed when Savage was introduced for an interview and never came out. The Nasty Boys joined the NWO at the hotel, and Jerry Sass been over spreading his ass cheeks, do an impersonation of Eric Bischoff, which really upset Bischoff to the fact that he walked off the set legit to call the hotel to bitch him out, and it was teased that Bischoff was going to the hotel to confront the NWO on television to explain his absence. Savage was pissed off because Elizabeth was at the party because she signed an acting contract with Hogan but wants to get out of it. Hogan brought out his son Nick, Nasty Nick, and Kyle Petty as well as the party, because he was driving the NWO race car for NASCAR. I remember this, and wow. Yeah, this, the NWO at the hotel deal. I you know, when I was at the the Nitro in Columbus, which was a few weeks before this, because it was right before Fall Brawl, where the NWO, you know, made a very, you know, quick appearance. And the fans were so pissed off at that, that they were only showed up for a little bit. I can only imagine what it'd been like to be a, you know, a fan in Cleveland. And the hottest act in professional wrestling is at a hotel. And they don't have the video wall at Nitro. So they're not even seeing what's going on. Basically, they're getting nothing. They're just sitting there.
They didn't they didn't have video wall at Nitro until the Russo era, did they?
Yeah, but they would take a video wall on the road, though, on those tapings. They rolled it out. You never saw it. They just rolled it out and then rolled it back.
Oh, before that.
Yeah. So, Mike, I mean, you're paying customer, and you're sitting there for a while there as these skits are going on, and you're not getting your star power that you want to see. They're full within their rights to throw trash.
Yeah, I mean, but that's kind of this is the story of WCW, really. If you think about it, I mean, how many times they didn't screw people over with advertised lineups. I mean, so it's not surprising that they would do it at their peak. They did it at their lowest, and they here they are. There was always, no matter how hot WCW was, like, and this is really, we're getting towards the peak of how hot they were. There were always these signs of things like, well, why would you do this?
Exactly, and of course, like I said, this is on the WWE Network. So if you want to go back and watch this piece of shit, it's right there for $9.99.
Now, because I know the Wild feed of the hotel stuff used to be around.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that. Yeah, if you had a dish, you could find the backhaul feed from the hotel room and see Kevin Sullivan, after the NWO segments, handing the guys their scripts, telling them where to sit and what to say. It's amazing something that bad was actually scripted. Anyway, after the show ended, those watching on dishes could see Savage and Liz walk back into the room where Eric Bischoff, Sullivan, and the NWO guys were all talking about what a great job they'd done.
Yeah, I remember that was a hot tape back in like the mid-90s in the trading scene. And I remember, like, the Nitro goes off the air with like Savage chasing Elizabeth in the hallway and screaming at her that she signed this contract. And then as the show goes off the air, then they start laughing and they walk back into the room together. It's great. Yep. I'm pretty sure it's on YouTube, that whole thing.
Yeah, a lot of the satellite feed stuff, I think, is on YouTube and Daily Motion. I mean, some of it gets taken down sometimes. I mean, there's stuff I don't even remember being around. Like, I remember there's one where you can see it's from, like, earlier in the day before Judgment Day 2000, and it's, like, the hard cam pulled way back on the empty arena.
Yeah, I had never heard of that one.
That it's, but then someone edited it together to next to the Triple H Rock match, and it's Rock and Triple H going over their match.
That one showed up in the YouTube era, but I don't remember that being around back, you know, back in the day when all those satellite feeds were being traded all the time.
Which, actually, well, I won't say his name, but an early Ring of Honor pro wrestler, I remember, was responsible for most of those.
Eric Tuttle?
Gee, thanks. You know what? Who cares?
You didn't want to say it. I'll say it.
Fine.
There we go. We finally got somebody with some balls here.
The Extreme Towel Boy.
There we go.
Don't blue ball the audience.
Well, we've already talked about Mike Rapata. So.
All right.
So anyway, back to Nitro. Billy Kidman who we mentioned earlier, had to work as El Technico on the show, teaming with Juventud Guerrera to lose to Public Enemy for the WCW tag titles because Psicosis, who was the original partner for Hoobie, didn't have his working visa in order. Now, Johnny Grunge, who was having knee surgery, and Rocco Rock, who was having surgery to remove bone chips from his shoulder, would force the TPE to lose their tag titles the next night at the TV tapings in Canton, Ohio, to Harlem Heat. And in typical WCW fashion, on the promo package for Halloween Havoc, they aired on Raw that night, they listed the tag title match as Harlem Heat defending against Scott Hall and Kevin Nash. That match, the TPE Harlem Heat match, went 5:40 when Colonel Parker hooked Grunge's knee with the cane and Stevie Ray hit Grunge's knee with the cane to get the pin. Probably more eventful than the title change, though, was a disturbance during the match in the crowd when a few black fans were fighting with a few white fans, which distracted most of the crowd from the match itself. It was covered up on television by making it appear the crowd was distracted because the NWO was in the stands, which they were. Match was really bad, with a bad finish as well. And like I said, this was interesting timing because, you know, Public Enemy had lost their tag titles, and it was known, I guess, on the underground that they had lost the belts. So with the ECW Arena show happening 4 nights later,
you know,
those smart fans were probably really thinking that was Public Enemy. So that, what an interesting little deal there Paul did, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that Hall of Me Public Enemy feud, that was some bad matches.
You know, the thing is, it wasn't good, but it was also the peak, ended up being the peak of Public Enemy's time in WCW.
Yeah. And poor Public Enemy, you know, once they left the home atmosphere of ECW, boy, they were so exposed.
I mean, it was, I think Ted Petty maybe had been a pretty good worker in his youth, but, I mean, grunge was never that good, and all of a sudden, Rocco was looking his age.
Yeah, it was pretty rough. Mike, interesting, they had a little race war in the building. And I could tell from, you know, going to shows back in the day at Center Stage and Macon, where Harlem Heat was mega over. They had a great black fan following. And I can see where there would be maybe some situations that would come up. It's just interesting that, you know, 1996, we're having this happen, though, at a wrestling show.
Yeah, and then the most famous example of that, at least with Harlem Heat, would be those Hog Wild shows were pretty scary.
Oh, yes, totally, the bikers.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, you kind of feel bad for him being put in that situation, but the tag team scene, I mean, everybody knew that whoever the champions were just placeholders for Hall and Nash to eventually win the tag titles. And I'm surprised it took as long as it did, but they actually won it. Because they showed up, you know, they had their first match in July and not win the tag titles until October.
Was it Halloween Havoc or?
Yeah, I think so.
I think, or was it World War III?
It was Havoc.
All right, the main event of that Nitro, though, going back to that piece of shit, was Chris Benoit over Rick Steiner in 4 minutes, 25 seconds. That's right. When Steve McMichael used the briefcase. Oh, God.
No. The Halliburton.
The Halliburton. On Rick as Deborah distracted the referee. The crowd was dead by this point. Even in that match, which had the potential to be great, I don't know about that, wasn't even good. Arn Anderson, a woman, browbeat Liz about her sympathizing with Savage during two interviews, and she didn't come to ringside with Anderson for his match with Chris Jericho, which also was not a really good match, either considering, you know, who it was. And that was probably the only time they wrestled.
Yeah.
Because, of course, Arn would get hurt, you know, at Havoc. So,
now, I have a question.
Yeah.
Am I the only one that got very confused about what Halliburton was once they started to get older and see them in the news after growing up on McMichael on Nitro?
I was confused because I knew what it was.
My age, so. Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I do remember them constantly calling it the Halliburton. I don't really remember hearing about it.
Did Halliburton make metal briefcases?
No.
That's what it's always been called, though. That's almost always. I mean, you listen to old wrestlers, Harley Race, his Halliburton. You know, he always carried his world title belt in his Halliburton briefcase.
So maybe it's a Southern wrestling thing, Bix.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yes, WWF too sophisticated to be.
Yeah, they would never say a word like that. They put WWE in front of it.
Halliburton makes brief. Yeah, they made briefcases.
Yeah, I'm Googling this right now. Yeah, I guess it's a. Like,
and they still sell them.
Yeah, I guess they're rugged or something. I mean, it's a secure. That's the secure briefcase you bring into a war zone or something.
Here's one for $875 on firstdibs.com, 1970s version. So there's your Harley Race gold briefcase.
It's the type you would have put the money in during the Ric Flair bounty angle.
Exactly. Now, going back to Nitro, they drew a 3.3 rating. We're 3.4 first hour, 3.1 second hour, which is the biggest second hour drop in the history, which speaks for volume for the quality of the show, and a 5.0 share. Now, Monday Night Raw did a 2.3 rating with a 3.3 share. While the Nitro replay, that's right, they were doing Nitro replays at midnight, did a 1.4 rating and a 3.0 share. It's the fifth consecutive week that Nitro ratings have dropped from the week before, and second straight week, and third of the last four, where there has been a major turnoff factor as the show goes on. Still, I'm sure the company would be thrilled with averaging a 3.3 for the year. Word we get is that Bischoff recognized just how bad a show it was when the ratings came in. Now, other weekend numbers saw Main Event do a 1.4, Saturday night, do a 2.5, and Pro, do a 1.3. Now, Bix, you're the ratings guy here.
I am. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about the NWO, how great an angle it was, but look at the numbers here.
And they're not gigantic numbers.
They're dropping.
Yeah.
What puts them over the top, though? I mean, what do you think was the main deal that got them to those big ratings heights?
You want me to look right now, Nitro ratings history? Because I'm trying to remember when they really started to go up. Let's see. So we are in late 96, and...
Now, my way, he's doing that. You know, I think a lot of that had to do with the NWO was being so dominant. And WCW was being made like complete fools that people were, that weren't happy.
Yeah, I mean, it was during that period where literally every single week was those NWO beatdowns. But I think, I don't know, by late September, I think it was still kind of fresh. It wasn't to the point where they had beaten it into the ground. I know when there's a point like around like October or November where like they end Nitro every week with like a Hogan interview. And then he poses where it gets like real, like it kind of gets out of hand. But also it's important to mention, I think, what time is Raw starting at this point? I think Raw is still at 9 o'clock.
Nine.
And then Raw moves to 8 with the Brian Pillman gun angle about a month later.
But weren't they also, I think they had started trying to get the jump on them a few minutes early at this point, right?
They're probably like 8:57, or, and then Nitro's like 8, well, Nitro was 8:55, and then it was before it went 2 hours.
And didn't Nitro do it first with an unannounced early start with the NWO in the ring?
Definitely, yep.
Having beat up the job, whoever, like whatever prelim wrestlers it was or something?
Yeah, definitely. So I think there may be a turnaround in the Nitro pattern when Raw moves to 8 in November.
Let's see, because I'm not seeing giant changes. November, I mean, we go back up a little, 3.5 at the end of October, 3.4, 3.2. I mean, it doesn't look like it gets real, the big dominance is until later. Yeah, I mean, they start going into fours in, like, late 97. So I guess the Sting ramping up is when it got really big. Yeah.
Yeah. So the NWO gets all the credit, but really Sting, I guess, should be getting the credit. And isn't that interesting? That's just a talking point now.
Now it is.
We got Hall of Fame season, and
well, I already sent my ballot in.
And I've already sent my ballot in too. But wow, that's something I never really thought about before. Is going back and look at the numbers. And looking at, you know, how things changed, but it looks like to us, you know, from going in that when the Sting angle got hot, ratings are going up. And I remember merchandise was exploding because everybody and their brother was buying the black Sting Scorpion shirt. I had the shirt and the mask myself. And I remember I had the Sting action figure too, the one they came out with from San Francisco Toy Company. And that's interesting. Okay.
I mean, if you take the Sting stuff out of the NWO era, that 96, 97, I mean, who knows if it would have been as big without him, right?
Oh, definitely. Like, I totally agree.
If their lead baby faces they were feuding against were Lex Luger and Savage, I don't know that it would have been anywhere near as big.
Or even if you had regular Sting.
Yeah, if you had regular Sting, it's nowhere near as big. So it's an interesting little talking point.
We should take a closer look at that later.
Yeah. Yeah, this definitely. Because Hall of Fame season, of course, we turn our ballots in. And
As we're recording this, they're due. I mean, they're due now. This is going up, yeah.
Yeah, they're due right now. So, interesting. All right. Anyway, back to the show at hand. J.J. Dillon, who we talked about earlier, has started working in the office on October 1st. Although he won't have a role on camera. Oh, that changed. Bischoff had a pep talk before the September 23rd Nitro with the wrestlers, saying that he wanted to beat McMahon by 1.5 again. And he told the wrestlers that Dillon would be coming in and apologized to Kevin Sullivan, saying that Dillon would be his assistant because he's heard that Dillon's a good organizer and said that he was apologizing because it was the first chance he had gotten to tell Sullivan about this. Ironically, this Dillon deal was probably a done deal a long time ago because one major WCW figure was bragging back in late April about how Dillon was coming in, and Dillon had his house in Connecticut for sale for several months, then quit with no notice when the house closed.
Okay, we should probably explain this a bit. Now, have either of you read JJ's book?
I haven't, no.
No, I haven't either.
Okay, so there are a few things to go over here. Now, also, did either of you listen to Bischoff on Flayer's podcast?
I did, yeah.
Yes, I did, yeah.
Okay, so why don't we start with that, since I guess that's happened more recently. So I thought it was interesting that Bischoff said that he hired JJ basically as a favor to, who was it that he said pitched JJ? Flair?
Was it Nash? I thought it was Nash.
It was Nash.
Kevin Nash, yeah.
Yeah,
Kevin Nash.
Because, you know, said, well, you know, JJ's a good guy. I really enjoy, you know, he was good to work under WWF, and he has a special needs kid and blah, blah, blah. So we hired him as an agent and you know, with maybe other positions, you know, to move up to later. And then he lost a lot of respect for JJ because early on he said JJ showed him he had kept internal WWE pay documents and stuff. Now, Bischoff, I guess, has been saying this for a long time because in his book, I think JJ said, Bischoff has said this about me, but I never did that. Like he said, I might have said something like, you know, obviously I remember what these guys were getting paid so I can help you be competitive, but he said I never would have showed, you know, proprietary company information. So then the other thing, because there were a few things that were like reported about this back then and all that, was his version of what happened is that he had gotten fed up with Vince and WWF really going back to when they cut the pay on all of the office staff with wrestling backgrounds, which we've talked about before, when the year earlier when Lord Alfred Hayes left. And the other stuff too, like Vince really pressured him into buying a house when it really wasn't something he could afford in Stamford. And he liked the house he was renting in. I think he even ended up buying that. And he just basically, he knew he was going to leave and he wasn't sure he was going to go anywhere. But he sold his house, you know, he put his house on the market, and when he sold, that was the day he quit. And also, there was also the thing that he had bumped into Scott Hall at Disney, both just there on vacation, although maybe Hall was there in conjunction with WCW stuff as well. Someone saw them together. That led to, A, people thinking he had already been talking to WCW, because this is back when he was with WWF, and B, because WWF, like, Vince was, JJ says Vince was ready to offer him a severance deal where it's like, I'll take care of you, I understand your point of view on all this, you'll get a severance package, you can figure out your next move, you'll be taken care of, etc. That was then used to go back on that, saying that he had been talking to WCW. At least that's JJ's version of it. So, a couple very different versions of what happened with JJ going to WCW.
What do you think is the closest to the truth?
JJ's. I mean, which sounds more true? I mean,
yeah.
I could see maybe there's something a little closer to the middle than it gets at, like, but maybe JJ had composed a list of what he remembered people getting paid or something. You know what I mean? Like something that wasn't officially prepared, but I don't see it being, and even that's probably a little too far, but his sounds a little more realistic. And also if he already had the job, why that sounds like something more he would have done to try to get the job.
Yeah. I think,
or that someone would try to do to get the job.
Maybe somebody else did that. I don't know.
And it's also interesting to think about in hindsight with the Brian Wittenstein stuff too. With TNA and WWE.
Yeah, I mean, I would think somebody probably did do that with Bischoff, but it may not have been JJ. Maybe somebody.
Who else would there have been if someone did do it?
I really don't know.
Did anyone else come over from the office?
I can't remember, but who knows? But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting little deal. And of course, the deal where he went with that role on camera, that changed quick.
Yeah. Well, he hadn't been on camera for years, though, so
yeah,
that was probably the expectation.
And boy, did they make him look a fool on camera, too.
Oh, God, especially during the Sting thing.
Yeah, poor JJ. Because JJ still had that cachet among all the fans of being the manager of the Four Horsemen, and here he is basically working as a neutered dog.
Yeah, and then just everything, too, like when they bring him in, and it like he was supposed to look authoritative, but he's really just pointing at the NWO and saying, oh, I'm going to, whatever. He really didn't get to do anything, though. It's not like he was given any power to do anything. And it's like, and also you think back, I mean, as good as the angle where Harvey Schiller suspends Bischoff is, and it works because it's the TBS executive as opposed to a wrestling guy,
that's something you could do with JJ. I mean, I think it works better the way they did it, but they just did. They didn't do anything with him behind the scenes or on camera when they could have done a lot more.
And one side thing I want to talk about, you know, you mentioned the Bischoff. Bischoff's, the stuff with JBL and the stuff with Flair, everybody should listen, watch it, whatever, because it's really good stuff. Really good. I mean, Bischoff may not be telling the exact truth on a lot of stuff, but more often than not, I think he is on a lot of things, especially like behind the scenes regarding Turner officials. There's a lot of stuff that you don't hear talked about as much. So I thought it was really strong stuff. Yeah. Like I said, there may be some inaccuracies, and I'm sure there is. That's wrestling.
And he has a terrible memory.
And he has a terrible memory, but of some stuff. But I thought it was strong stuff. But anyway, our last bit of news here, and this is just a little fun little bit. Otto Vons, former AWA World Heavyweight Champion, and JBL, who loves to mention him every damn television show, was at the Cleveland and Canton WCW shows, attempting to book talent to keep his company alive. Of course, his company was CWA in Austria. And Regal was going over there. Finley was going over there. Ice Train, Hard Work Bobby Walker. So he got talent to come over there. And then, of course, WCW did a tour in December or so, I think, of the of that area. Or they, I know they sent some talent through it. But, yeah, Bix, you know, talk about the CWA and, you know, what they were like in this time period.
I'm trying. Okay, so this is around the time. This is your Ulf Herman versus Ultimate Warrior time period, I guess.
Yeah, this is, and this has been the year after, you know, Tenzan had been over there. New Japan was always still sending guys over there. And, yeah, this is when you have all those great catch wrestling tournaments.
Yeah, I mean, they're just kind of the, there's less European talent to draw from.
Cannonball Grizzly.
Yes. Yeah, this is when PN News really made a second career for himself.
And I mean, Mantar. Big career. His brother.
I mean, were they actually, I thought they, were they brothers or are they brothers?
From
what
I thought
they
were
just partners. No, wasn't there an article where they said they were trying, that claimed to be going back to WWF years ago or something, where, I don't think they were brothers, but they've been, they were tag team partners.
Well, maybe they were telling people they were brothers. I don't know.
It's wrestling.
Yeah. But anyway, I mean, it was a big man's promotion.
Yeah, I mean, they had some good spots for smaller guys too. Well, the main events were the big guys. I mean, that to work with Wands or Wands type, Wands size guys. But they had an eclectic selection of guys on the under. You know, you'd have your, well, if just to work with Japanese guys, or Scorpio came through. Well, you know what though? Not necessarily, because Finley was really his big star and drawing card in the 90s.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I necessarily. I get what you're saying, but wasn't Finley pretty much his biggest draw?
Pretty much.
So it's not necessarily a big guy's promotion in that sense, but I mean, there was still good stuff going on. I mean, Finley was back there at this point, but it was just kind of fading away because, like, Europe just did not have as much of a base for, you know, of talent as it did before or as it would in a few years later. I mean, like, I'm thinking about, I mean, Ulf Herman was a good wrestler, and I mean, you had some other guys like Victor Kruger, but otherwise, like, who really did you have in different parts of Europe? I mean, you had a couple British guys that were getting some attention. You had Dirt Bike Kid, Andre Baker. I'm thinking maybe Doug Williams was about to start wrestling. And a couple other guys like in Eastern Europe, but really you didn't have as much local talent to draw from. And more guys are just getting signed as far as free agents. So there's just less talent for him to work with, which it's a shame because that was, you hear from so many guys who work those tournaments, and what a great learning experience it was for them because they're working in front of the same crowd every night for a month, you know?
Yeah. And a lot of guys went over there. A lot, you know, people that you don't know about, especially in the 80s, went over there and did those things.
Yeah, and I just realized what I should have had in honor of us talking about this. I should have looked up the Observer with the letter from, who was it, Tokyo Joe? When Dave made jokes about Tenzan going on steroids while he was
in
TWA.
Oh, that was great.
He was like, no, Mr. Yamamoto has been on a very special high-protein diet to gain weight, or whatever it was to gain weight. And he was like, I think the thing there was, it was more that they were upset at the idea, the implication that Otto was the one getting him steroids or something. Wasn't it something like that? Because Dave's apology was like, I apologize for bringing Otto Wands' name into it, wasn't it?
Well,
it
was Germany. You know, they weren't like the steroids weren't flowing freely there. Look at their Olympians.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's the type of thing that's just not around anymore, really, at all. I mean, you have a pretty strong indie scene in Germany, I guess, but...
Well, the UK is the dominant scene.
Now, the UK is the scene right now. And I mean, do they still have, as far as like places to learn, is Brian Dixon still doing the holiday camps?
I don't think so.
Well, that's too bad.
It's all promotions now.
That kind of sucks because, I mean, you always heard UK fans crap on it, but like that guys learn there because it was all, you know, work in front of kids, a few couple shows a day, that type of thing. Like, I remember the one that really sticks out is, I mean, when Brian Danielson came back from those UK tours, he was like a different guy. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Just so much more confident, better working a crowd and all that, so.
Yeah.
And that's the one, I mean, the indies are in an interesting period right now. It seems like there is a decent amount of work, and guys, if you're able to make a name, you can earn some decent money. But you don't have, like, that one place where you can go and spend some time and learn anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It is a different time period. All right, we're going to the plugs section. Mike, are you got anything to plug, or what you got?
No, I don't think I got anything to plug. I'm good.
You have an internet job. Plug the site you work for. Plug your day job.
Oh, well, I could plug my day job, I suppose. I work for collegehumor.com.
That's a great site. Yeah.
Yeah. So you could check that out.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Bix, you got enough plugs for everybody. So go ahead and rattle off your list of of various articles, podcasts, soliloquies, anything you got going on.
Interpretive dance. So the new Fighting Spirit magazine is now out. I have two pieces in there. I have my history of the World Bodybuilding Federation, as well as...
Gary Striden, baby!
As well as a profile of Bill After that actually Bill sent me a really nice note about, so that actually meant a lot to me. And also, you know, just got my stuff at scscoops.com, MMAnews.com, daily updates on Saturday, Tuesday, Wednesday at WrestlingObserver.com. I've got, I guess this is the only regular podcast I'm doing right now, but I was kind of telling Dylan we should probably do another trademarks and if there's something. Am I forgetting something? I don't know. I don't think I am. But
you know what? You know we forgot to mention on this show, and I just now thought about it because I was thinking about Yokozuna. We mentioned him because I was thinking about Yokozuna because you're talking about mentioning working for SE Scoops, which anytime I hear Scoops, I think of Yokozuna. But Bam Bam Bigelow worked the ECW Arena show, made his debut on that show against Terry Gordy. Yeah, I failed to mention that.
Battle of the Bam Bams.
Battle of the Bam Bams. So Bam Bam Bigelow meets his quota on this podcast, Between the Sheets.
We had gone a couple of weeks without him, though.
Yeah, well, in 1984 was last week.
Well, so but I think with the week before, what was the week before, 94?
Yeah, so we have a few things. We pretty much talk about every show. Bam Bam Bigelow is one of them.
No one got arrested, though.
No one got arrested. ECW was not having not having television problems at this time period.
Either, no.
So, yeah, we're missing some stuff, but yes. Bam Bam Bigelow.
Is there anything we haven't been tracking besides ECW television, Bam Bam Bigelow, and arrests?
Yeah, that's about the main thing.
Well, everything mid-90s is also me talking about WWF and WWF syndication in New York, so this was a good week to talk about that.
Yeah. And you know, talk about the Bama, they really played that up on television. So great, Paul did. I mean, he really pimped that match hard when they were advertising the commercial video for that.
Oh, they played that commercial till they played that one to death more than any other tape they sold.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, are you Bama. Talking about the night Kimono Wanalea danced at the ECW Arena?
Yes.
And now, actually,
Extreme Warfare, Volume 2.
They never did a Volume 3 or anything, but. Yeah, they advertised the hell out of Volume 2. And, of course, didn't Paul tell Kimona that he wasn't taping the striptease when the ring was broken at Hardcore Heaven?
Yeah. That's a whole other story for a whole other show.
But you know what? When you mentioned that, though, was Paul booking Windy City when they did the original Battle of the Bam Bams?
Yes.
There you go.
There we are. All right. My plugs. Follow me on Twitter at KRISZELNER. for all my random thoughts and marking out over Barnsville Wrestling whenever they do those shows. We got Exile on Bad Street, hopefully. And I know it's going to be late due to health issues of my editor, but the Lucha show for the Hall of Fame section in the Wrestling Observer newsletter hopefully will be out sometime in this current week. Yeah, I know it's after the fact, but it's a really great show I did with Alfredo Esparza and Cubs fan.
Now, going across, what about, and, wait a second, what about the historical U.S. show with me and TBA?
I ran out of time.
Well, we can still do it after the ballots go in.
We'll do it for 2016.
Oh, wonderful.
But anyway, yeah, there's just so much going on. But yeah, that show is in the can, so it'll be out sometime soon. Of course, the Place to Be Nation MSG reaction show went up yesterday, and what a piece of shit show that was. we eviscerated that it'd be on that show.
I have not. I still haven't watched it. I was watching UFC.
Oh man, it's something else. And other than that, we got these shows every Monday. We'll discuss sometime during this week what the next show is going to be, and get that figured out. And all that good stuff. And that's about it right now. Listen to all the Place to Be Nation shows.
I should plug our Twitters. I keep forgetting to plug up my Twitter.
At David Bick.
Yes, and at Chris Elner. And we won't plug Mike's because I know he likes to kayfabe his.
Yeah, but, hey, there's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that.
Appreciate
it. You know, and some people don't want it out there in the open like that. So, you know, that's good. But, yeah, the NXT is coming up Wednesday, so we'll have that reaction show that will drop that Thursday, which that should be an interesting show.
God, there's so much stuff this week.
Yeah, I know, man.
Think about it. So Friday, so we had
TakeOver on Wednesday.
No, but going back even, so we had UFC, MSG, Bound for Glory, Heroes Immortales, NXT. Am I forgetting it? Oh, Shine had an eye pay per view.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on, but anyway. It's been a great show. Mike, we'll definitely have you back on in the future.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it. A lot of fun.
Awesome. Bix, of course, you're great, as usual. And I'm just your humble host. And on that note, for Mike, for Bix, it's Chris saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia.